This is Audible. Recorded Books and One Click Digital present Drop the Rock by Bill P., Todd W., and Sarah S., narrated by Tom Zingarelli. Usefulness Prayer. God, help me today to find balance between my character defects and the principles of our program, so as to be useful to myself, all others, and you, the God of my understanding. Step 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Preface. It has been more than 12 years since the first edition of Drop the Rock was published. During that time, I've presented the book in seminars, retreats, and talks ranging in length from 1 to 12 hours. The positive response to Drop the Rock is more than I ever expected. I have especially enjoyed hearing that many sponsors give a copy of the book to their sponsees after listening to their fifth step. Many 12-step members hold Drop the Rock groups at members' homes. They meet one night a week over a specified number of weeks, usually 8. As I do in my longer seminars, the group leader preassigns the personal stories in the book to individuals. When that story is reached in the sequence of the book, the assigned member usually reads the story and comments on how he or she identifies with the character's story. The new material in this second edition has been added as a result of comments received from individuals who have read the first edition and knowledge I have obtained throughout my recovery journey, which has now moved into its 26th year. When I first joined AA, I thought the Big Book's program of action was saying 1,000 things. I slowly began to understand that it is saying a few simple things 1,000 times. During the early 1980s, I worked in the archives at AA headquarters in New York, and one of the most asked questions was, what is the difference between character defects and shortcomings? The answer is that there is no difference. Bill W. and the other authors of the Big Book didn't want to use the same word in both steps. The same approach is used in this book. Character defects is used interchangeably with shortcomings. Nell Wing, Bill W.'s longtime secretary and the first archivist at AA, and I found the original Mary Drop the Rock story, which begins the introduction of this book, in an old intergroup newsletter. On occasion, this book gets confused with the famous 1976 AA convention talk by Sandy B. called Drop the Rock. Although Sandy's Dropping the Rock image is only 3 minutes of a 50-minute talk, it has become legendary. Thanks, Sandy, for letting us include your Drop the Rock parable in this edition. Thank you to all those who have contributed to the production of this second edition, as we remember that we will always be students in the program, we remain teachable and open to new opportunities, and we open our minds to accept and our hearts to understand. Bill P., September 2004. Introduction. Seems there was this group of 12-step members taking a boat ride to this island called Serenity. And it was truly a happy bunch of people. As the boat pulled away from the dock, a few on board noticed Mary running down the street trying to catch up with the boat. One member said, "Darn, she's missed the boat." Another said, "Maybe not. Come on, Mary, jump in the water. Swim, swim, you can make it. You can catch up with us." So Mary jumped into the water and started to swim for all she was worth. She swam for quite a while and then started to sink. The members on board, now all aware that Mary was struggling, shouted, "Come on, Mary, don't give up. Drop the rock." With that encouragement, Mary started swimming again, only to start sinking again shortly afterward. She was going under when she heard all those voices shouting to her, "Mary, drop the rock. Let go and drop the rock." Mary was vaguely aware of something around her neck, but she couldn't quite figure out what it was. Once more, she gathered her strength and started swimming. She was doing quite well, even gaining a little on the boat, but then she felt this heaviness pulling her under again. She saw all those people on the boat holding out their hands and hollering for her to keep swimming and shouting, "Don't be an idiot, Mary! Drop the rock!" Then she understood when she was going down for the third time. This thing around her neck, this was why she kept sinking, when she really wanted to catch the boat. This thing was the rock they were all shouting about. Resentments, fear, dishonesty, self-pity, intolerance, and anger were just some of the things her rock was made of. God, help me get rid of the rock, she prayed. Now, get rid of it. Mary managed to stay afloat long enough to untangle a few of the strings holding that rock around her neck, realizing as she did that her load was easing up. Then, with another burst of energy, she let go. She tore the other strings off and dropped the rock. Once free of the rock, she was amazed how easy it was to swim, and she soon caught up with the boat. Those on board were cheering for her and applauding and telling her how great she was and how it was so good having her with them again, and how now they could get on with the boat ride and have a nice time. Mary felt great and was just about to indulge in a little rest and relaxation when she glanced back to shore. There, a ways back, she thought she saw something bobbing in the water, so she pointed it out to some others. Sure enough, someone was trying to catch the boat, swimming for dear life but not making much headway. In fact, it looked like the person was going under. Mary looked around and saw the concern on the faces of the other members. She was the first to lean over the rail and shout, "Hey, friend, drop the rock!" Mike shares his experience with dropping the rock. Before its discussion of step four, the big book says, "Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions." A thorough inventory reveals those causes and conditions. The fifth step allows us to share them with God and another human being, and so remove the inner pain they have caused in our past lives. After finishing my fifth step, I discarded the inventory but kept a single page that listed my major character defects. That list would come in handy later. The first time I read step six, I thought it meant I had to arrive at some angelic state of mind in which I would become and forever remain entirely ready to have God remove all my defects. I had forgotten that AA promises spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. 12 and 12 set me right. It calls step 6 AA's way of stating the best possible attitude one can take in order to make a beginning on this lifetime job. To me, that means step 6 is not a one-time matter. It stretches over a lifetime of recovery. Even that best possible attitude is always just the beginning. One morning while I was at Hazelden's Fellowship Club in St. Paul, Minnesota, I awoke very early and knew it was time to make that beginning. I took out the list of defects, read it over, and asked myself two questions. Why are you holding on to these things? And what did these things ever do for you? I may choose to hold on to them for fear of letting go, but holding on to them for years and years led me into alcoholism. So I got on my knees and recited the Big Book's Step 7 prayer, which asks God's help in replacing our willfulness with His will for us. The 12 and 12 calls that replacement a basic ingredient of all humility. I went to Hazelden for treatment because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I believe we get active with step 6 when we get sick and tired of being sick, sick and tired of the character defects of which alcoholism is a symptom, sick and tired of their effect, not on our past, but on our present lives. In this ongoing process, the program is asking us to go where none of us has ever been before, into lives of lessened fear, diminished anger, fewer resentments, and the genuine self-esteem instead of self-pity. There is a price, however. The willingness to challenge and change patterns of thought, speech, and behavior that may have gone unchallenged for 10, 20, 30 years or more. These stories from Mary and Mike are good illustrations for a better understanding of working the sixth and seventh steps. The first five steps have supplied the foundation for recovery. The next two steps begin the active day-to-day solution, removing what blocks us from our usefulness to other people and to our higher power, and especially and ultimately what blocks us from ourselves. There are four basic reasons we won't be entirely ready to work the sixth and seventh steps. The first is a conscious decision that we will never give up a specific character defect. Next, we blame our defects on others, people, situations, or institutions. Third, we rationalize. Our capacity to rationalize is unlimited. Before recovery, we spent years on this one, throwing up barriers against unpleasant realities. Finally, it's denial, we are totally unaware of our own contribution to our problems. The order of the 12 steps occurs for a reason. There's not much use in doing our amends in steps 8 and 9 if there is no sign of our willingness to change by doing step 6 and 7. How many times in active addiction did we say we were sorry without the slightest intent of changing our behavior so we wouldn't have to say we were sorry again? Working steps 8 and 9 is hollow unless we've begun working the sixth step with humility as our guide. The promises in the big book come after the discussion of steps 8 and 9. Let's look at the words of Sam Shoemaker to gain some clarity on what the sixth and seventh steps are asking of us. Sam was the Episcopal clergyman who ran Calvary Church and Mission, where first Ebbie T. and then Bill W., AA's co-founder and primary author of the Big Book, began their recovery. Bill W. credited Shoemaker with passing on to him and the early AAs the spiritual keys that make up the program and the 12 steps. Shoemaker wrote about the necessity of making daily surrenders. Yes, the sixth step is also about surrendering, just like the third, but Shoemaker made one point very clear. We surrender as much of ourselves to as much of God as we understand. In other words, our spiritual progress is based in direct proportion to our dropping the rock. We are very fortunate that all of our defects aren't revealed to us all at once. Recovery works by giving us daily insight into what we can do to remove what blocks us. We need a daily awareness that our character defects are the opposite of the principles of our program. Shoemaker also passed on to the early AAs the idea that God reveals as much truth as you can live up to. That statement puts us directly on page 164 of the Big Book, where it says, "The answers will come if your own house is in order." The sixth step helps us do that. Some have called the sixth and seventh steps the forgotten steps, because they aren't talked about that much. Others have called these steps the most important. Perhaps the whole program is about six and seven. By working the sixth and seventh steps, we are less likely in recovery to stay stuck in old, unproductive, negative behavior patterns. We gain more understanding on how all the steps, although ordered for a reason, need to be worked together. This prevents us from falling into the trap of understanding only just enough of the program to make us miserable and not enough to make us happy. For example, some of us might fall into the trap of thinking the support system of the fellowship meetings is the entire program of action. The action of the sixth and seventh steps culminates in dropping the rock, all the stubborn, grasping, stupid holding on to old patterns of behavior, thinking, and feeling that are harmful to our progress in recovery. For another insight, let's return to Shoemaker, who believed progress in the spiritual life is based on our looking inward and upward, not outward and downward. Reading Drop the Rock is a way of getting into the principles behind the sixth and seventh steps, not only for understanding, but for action. We'll be examining at a number of ideas and examples of how men and women have made positive changes in their lives by working these steps and by showing up at meetings to tell others of their experiences. After doing our fifth step, many of us were directed to go home and to read the two paragraphs in the big book on the sixth and seventh steps and then do the steps. Who wouldn't want to be rid of those defects of character, especially after talking about them in the inventory process? We uncovered a list of pain and agony and then shared it with another person and God. Of course we wanted to be rid of those character flaws and habits, so we prayed to let our defects go and humbly asked God for help. We thought we had done the sixth and seventh steps, and that was that. Then, down the road, we started having the same difficulties and issues arising from the same defects that had plagued us before. We may not have practiced them or noticed them quite so much after doing a fifth step, but they returned with a force that scared and surprised us. We went back to our sponsor and said that perhaps we needed to do another fourth and fifth step. We were feeling and acting very similar to ways we used to feel and act. What should we do? Or perhaps after years in the program, things seem to just have gone flat. There doesn't seem to be the same old spark, and the meetings just aren't as interesting as they once were. We've drifted into a numb place where there seems to be little growth and little reason to change. Can we explain why we aren't entirely ready? Why can't we humbly ask, what's in our way? If our sponsor is a good one, perhaps he or she responds that maybe it isn't the fourth or fifth step that needs repeating, but that it is time to take a real look at the sixth and seventh. Rather than blaming the program and the people in it for the flatness in our life, maybe it's time to rejuvenate the growth process through a jump start of the sixth and seventh steps, remembering that the program helps those who help themselves. The program works for those who understand it. Bill's thoughts on principles versus character defects. I once spoke at an AA group's anniversary meeting in St. Paul, Minnesota, and left the members with a riddle. If the principles of 12-step recovery are not the 12 steps, then what are the principles? I returned to the same meeting about a year later to present a sponsee with a sobriety medallion, and a few people approached me with the following comment: "I've been looking all year since your talk in the literature for the principles and can't find them." My answer to these group members was the same one I give my sponsees. The principles of 12-step recovery are the opposite of our character defects. In recovery, we try to take the opposite of our character defects and shortcomings and turn them into principles. For example, we work to change fear into faith, hate into love, egoism into humility, anxiety and worry into serenity, complacency into action, denial into acceptance, jealousy into trust, fantasy into reality, selfishness into service, resentment into forgiveness, judgmentalism into tolerance, despair into hope, self-hate into self-respect, and loneliness into fellowship. Through this work, we learn to understand the principles of our program. Such work may look like an overwhelming goal to a spiritual reality, into living, so we can continue to change and grow and be useful. To become the person we can become, we must drop the rock. All the grasping and holding on to old patterns of behaving, thinking, and feeling that are harmful to ourselves and to others. The focus must become moving toward completion rather than away from unpleasant and uncomfortable habits and actions. Please join in this adventure of learning to put the sixth and seventh steps into action. Through these actions, we will be able to transform our life and relationships. Step 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. At the beginning of the discussion of the sixth step in the 12 and 12, it says, in a rather sexist way, that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Becoming entirely ready, moving into total willingness, is hard. It requires a great effort and awareness. Step 6 requires us to stop struggling. It is time to acknowledge that we need help. Not only help to stop our addiction, but help in living better lives. Having gone through steps 4 and 5, we become aware of our defects of character. Perhaps pride and thoughts of superiority are blocking the way to serenity, or it may be the habit of judging others. Perhaps it is a deep resentment, envy, or self-pity that keeps us in turmoil. It is good to go over step 6, over and over. It is brief and to the point. All it requires is becoming ready to become willing. We don't have to achieve change immediately. We can work on our attitude of mind and pray about it. We can think it over and see that our lives can become more trouble-free when we rid ourselves of destructive habits. Step 6 tells us to relax. We don't do it all alone. Reflect. We turn to our higher power with confidence. Think of the relief that is waiting once we become entirely ready. It's like heading into a hot shower after working at a grubby chore. Feeling the dirt wash away is great. We emerge refreshed and shining and ready to deal with whatever comes our way. We affirm to our higher power that we are ready to have God remove our defects. We continue in close and loving contact with God while we do our part in working on our shortcomings. Once we allow room for God to work in our lives, we are making it possible for wonderful changes to take place. We become more in balance with right living principles. We all know individuals in recovery who have given up the booze or another addiction, yet they are staying dry or abstinent only by redirecting their intense inner misery into the lives of others. They won't work the sixth and seventh steps. We'll be discussing the sixth step in terms of surrender. Surrender is mentioned many times in the program in many different contexts, yet it can be confusing and possibly misunderstood. For the sixth step, a spiritual surrender is necessary, not a passive, waiting surrender, but an active use of the will, a total surrender of mind, thinking, and body, doing. Surrender is usually brought up in the context of pain. When our life is unmanageable and causing pain, we must turn it over. When we decide to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understand Him, we've opened the door to surrender. In the third step, it is the decision that is the key point, an active use of the will to turn it over, to align our will with God's. In the sixth step, an even more active use of the will is required. We must act as if it has already taken place. We must have faith. Too many who take the fifth step make their confession and look around wondering where the solution lies. Let's hear from Deb. The sixth step is the perfectly logical place to be after having completed a thorough fifth step. Asking ourselves, do I want to give this defect up, is different than asking, do I want to be different? Regardless of what little I know about being different, I must first ask, am I willing to believe that I can be different? It is important to remember that step six doesn't say, became entirely ready to make myself different. It says, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. God, not me, makes me different by giving me what it takes to change. It is my job to act and behave like the change has occurred. In doing this, the process of change happens. Frequently, this involves emotional pain. The pain of living the way I have been becomes greater than the fear of change. It also involves the pain of attracting seemingly obnoxious people. These folks are mirrors of my defects. I get to experience how it feels to have the shoe on the other foot. This is a step of surrender and trust, not self-will or self-determination. We surrender our ideas of which defects stand in the way of our usefulness to God, ourselves, and others. Billy O. once gave me this example. At a recovery convention, someone I sponsor approached me to talk about a problem he was having. His mom was at the same convention, and he was unable to deal with it. He needed to talk to me about talking to her. I was practicing my defect of lust and enjoying being distracted by looking for available women. I blew him off. He ended up talking to his mom. I believe that God used my defect of lust to keep me unavailable to eliminate the middleman. The kid went straight to the source and used the tools he had to talk to his mom. This reminds me, how do I know when I'm being defective? God uses our defects and our assets in many ways to accomplish His will. Is there a fast track to spiritual perfection or progress? It is important to get over and beyond the false pride of making getting rid of character defects a central focus of our lives. This approach is just one more way of not living life on life's terms. We get into life and do the best we can with what we know. When we truly know better, we are willing to change. In the meantime, we live life. The hardest aspect of step six is controlling nature. I need to accept being human and fallible. Self-acceptance is more important than self-abuse. I cannot abuse myself into spirituality by shaming and ridiculing myself. I cannot open a flower with a sledgehammer. Only God opens flowers. In step six, I must trust that step seven follows. In the past, many of us have approached step six with outrageous self-will to change, or to the other extreme, with no will at all. I found that there is no standard of reference for the amount of emotional pain that an individual needs or can endure before being motivated to change. If I'm not changing my behavior because of pain, whom am I trying to impress? Could it be that I'm trying to live up to an ideal in order to make an impression? To take control by redefining my self-image? Is this not still self-centeredness and self-will? Spiritual pride? Yes, God uses defects to change me. But these questions are well worth asking ourselves as we consider our motives for change. In step six, our readiness to change comes from the awareness of how we are harming ourselves and therefore God. In order to remind myself that change is God's job, not mine, I use this prayer. God, I don't care what I sound like or look like, who my partners are, or where I live. I just don't want to be like this anymore. On your terms, in your time, please remake me as you will. Thank you. I don't get to choose which defects God will remove. I find that living with my defects continues to teach me humility. I find that the defects that made me an active threat to society were pretty much removed at once when I stopped my addictive chemical use. The defects that remove me from service are removed on and for the day that I ask. God lets me keep the rest of the defects to remind me of my need for daily spiritual contact. They remind me that there is a God and it isn't me. In order to have God remove our character defects, we must realize that we can't change ourselves completely by ourselves or have any lasting good purpose without spiritual intervention. Lack of power is our dilemma. We find a power by which we can live. How do we know when we are entirely ready? How do we know when we're hungry? Some have experienced an entire readiness as a feeling of being completely burned out or being at the end of their rope. Others have received a sponsor's validation of readiness. Most of us experience this readiness after we have become very familiar with the feeling or experience of not being ready or not being willing to be changed. We make friends with our defects and know how they have served us. This results in knowing how they no longer serve us. Defects of character are our best attempts to get our needs met. They have saved our lives. My problem was one of ignorance. I didn't know what my basic human needs were, and therefore didn't know how to meet them. I didn't know about the basic instincts of life, sociality, security, and sexuality, until I listened and studied a Joe and Charlie tape set. This is where the as you learn better, you do better applies. The hole in me, the neediness, the hunger, the ache in my life that I tried to fill or stay distracted from by using addictive behavior is actually the perfectly logical result of not knowing and therefore not accepting myself as I am. I was wrong, not bad. I did look bad, and I didn't get my needs met, so I ignorantly, apparently insanely, and desperately repeated what I knew. More, more, and more. Or less, less, and less. Deprivation and overconsumption are flip sides of the same coin. The point of recovery is finding the balance. Finding balance incorporates the awareness gained in steps 4 and 5 with the action, the behavior changes, and prayer gained in steps 6 and 7. Like the pendulum, we swing from one extreme of behavior to another, yet those points of extremes slowly become closer together. We change. As in the first step, finding balance involves admitting, accepting as true and valid to ourselves, that past attempts to meet our needs have failed. It is recognizing that we are truly bodily and mentally different than our fellows. We are real alcoholics and addicts. We must stay abstinent. If you're a real alcoholic or addict, you will stop using someday. It's better to be alive when it happens. Finding balance also includes recognizing that a predictable aspect of our disease is extreme action, consumption, deprivation, or repetition. This is how we become ready for finding the balance. We get to experience it. Yes, we do supply the willingness, but it is God who supplies the changes and the reasons for our willingness. Wanting to become willing to feel different is not foreign to us. It was this willingness that we used to feed our addictive behaviors. We wanted to feel different. Now, though, we ask God and we become ready to have our character defects removed by using our awareness of ourselves and our will to be different. In surrendering, we are saying our way hasn't worked. What a surprise. We are willing to try it another way. We desire to be at peace with our beliefs. We are fortunate people. We have the opportunity to face the battle of understanding our lives. We have another go-round at a life once abandoned. We want to be winners. Securely and absolutely. The willingness can be a sane and healthy choice or a reactive choice because of pain. We all get to choose. Sooner or later, we get to choose. When considering the sixth step, we find that this approach separates the winners from the losers. The winners actively seek and practice a new way of living, a new way of being, a new way of thinking, a new way of behaving, a new way of relating. The losers wait until they are in so much pain that the choice becomes obvious, and then they choose to participate only enough to get the pain to stop. Karen shares a realization she has had. Recently, I was perusing ahead in my daily meditation book when I came upon a quote by Martha Roth that piqued my curiosity. "Insight is cheap," she said. My first reaction was, "Gee, I don't agree with her. We in recovery place high value on insight. After all, it's our insight regarding the problem of addiction that makes us particularly helpful to the person who still suffers." But as I read the short essay following the quote, I began to see Ms. Roth's point. The essay talked about people who analyze themselves to death. They know exactly what makes them do the things they do. The tyrannical mothers, the abusive husbands, the poverty they were raised in, or the childhood of extreme indulgence and privilege. They have great insight, But instead of using that insight as a means to develop new and hopefully better behavior, they use it as a reason to continue with old, destructive behavior. They are not willing to go through the pain it takes to change, even though the pain of staying the same is killing them. They are victims. The list of people who've done them wrong is long, and the list of those people whose expectations they cannot live up to is even longer. They cling to their character defects with alarming tenacity, all the while blaming everything and everyone for their problems and never looking for solutions. In fact, they don't see their poor behavior as character defects at all, but more like genetic anomalies, such as bow legs or thin hair, or the permanent result of improper socialization by parents, who in most cases probably did the best job they could. Admitting that they might be somewhat at fault, they are sure others are more to blame. Therefore, instead of asking God to remove any defects of character, they secretly curse God for dealing them such a lousy hand. They are good at working with newcomers, especially if they find the newcomer attractive. The problem here is that all they want to do is talk about themselves, and all the newcomers want to do is talk about themselves. So these liaisons rarely last more than a few days or weeks before they bore each other to the brink of suicide. While they rarely balk at steps 4 and 5 because those steps give them the opportunity once again to dwell on their most beloved topic, themselves, they seem to get stuck at this point and gloss over or ignore completely those steps in the program that are vital to emotional and spiritual recovery, steps 6 and 7. Without emotional and spiritual recovery, you don't have much. You have abstinence, and you may not even have that for very long. If you don't follow the clear-cut directions of our program, you can't move into receiving God's directions. Before we move ahead with our discussion of Step 6, here's a story about attitude. Fred relates the outlook of 2 AA members. Don D. went to an AA meeting one evening. He frowned when a member mispronounced a few words while reading How It Works. He felt appalled when another member stood up and said he was an alcoholic and an addict. Another person talked too long. As he slipped out the door immediately after the meeting, Don D. muttered, "That was terrible. I should have stayed home." Bob M. went to a meeting one evening. His head was bowed as he listened to the preamble and How It Works. His eyes moistened as he listened intently to a member tell his story. He was grateful for being able to attend this meeting. After clean-up and a little socializing, he paused, and as he locked the meeting room door, his thoughts were, "Thank God for such a beautiful fellowship." Both AA members were at the same meeting. Each found what he was looking for. Choosing to move into willingness and being willing to choose, in other words, being willing to take responsibility, is a positive way of living. It is saying, "Hey, I'm worth moving toward being different without pain and resentment. I value myself and others enough to choose to make changes now rather than wait until I can't stand not making a choice." It is a completely different perspective than waiting until it hurts to make choices. The majority of us are very aware of our defects of character, but often it isn't until we are sick and tired of being sick and tired that we become willing to change. Acting as if the choice is already made and the changes in our lives are already in place puts the power of our will in line with the power of the universe so that we can move forward more gracefully into living without defects unchecked. Will it work? About as well as we surrender. Will it change our lives? Yes, without question. It is a matter of practice and willingness, of using the steps we've already taken to maintain our commitment. The more willing we become and the more we practice acting as if, the more active our surrender becomes and the more we are able to live as if. It is a fulfilling and rewarding process. Acting as if can raise questions of genuineness and authenticity. Is there a conflict with the person I am choosing to become and the person I currently am? Authenticity is being true to a vision and purpose. We are authentic when we choose to act and feel and choose to behave in balance with the higher values and principles we've chosen for our lives. If those principles and values are not fully in place and manifested, it doesn't make us phony. It makes us human. If we feel the conflict between who we are and who we would become, it is good. It signals that we understand the difference between reality and fantasy and are moving toward reality. There are many stages in surrendering and practicing. It's called progress. We will be discussing many of the stages in connection with the sixth step and again in working with the seventh. We will be discussing many of the things that hinder our ability to surrender and many of the defects of character that we may wish to remove. There is no magic in recovery. We get what we work for. Let's take a look at Charlie's story. When I first came in, I wanted all the good things people had, but I didn't want to work for them. Oh, I worked the steps, at least the ones I thought I needed, and when it came to step 6 and 7, I was ready and willing to have my higher power remove my shortcomings, should I have any, of course. I had no idea what they were because I didn't think I needed step 4, and I thought I could skip the vital step 5. But I prayed, vaguely, that should he see any shortcomings, I was ready for him to remove them. The principle of step 7 is humility. I had none. As I made progress in recovery, I became aware of many character defects and just how blind I had been to them. Mercifully, my higher power showed me only what I was ready to see. I became depressed, and I thought I could never be forgiven for or relieved from these shortcomings. This depression, I discovered, was not humility, but another form of playing God, believing my character defects were more powerful than my higher power's forgiveness. Then, when I recognized who had the power and who was powerless, I had to decide if I was entirely ready to ask him to remove my shortcomings. I had to quit playing God. After all, my character defects were what I thought made up my personality, and I was pretty much in love with whom I thought I was. Self-will had been my higher power for a lifetime. I was afraid, not knowing that something better would take the place of my character defects. With all the honesty I was capable of at the time, I worked the steps in order, 1 through 6, then 7, asking as humbly as I could that my higher power remove my shortcomings. They did not disappear. I was not struck pure. Then I was made aware that character defects are like active addiction. I couldn't keep using and expect God to relieve my disease. Neither could I keep practicing my character defects and expect God to remove them. I was going to have to develop a new set of habits, to work against who I thought I'd always been. And as I practiced these new habits, the old habits, character defects would begin to be replaced. This creates a period of grieving, which doesn't make sense at first. Why should I hurt over the leaving, letting go, removal of behaviors that only harmed me? So I began really living the principles of the program, using the support of the fellowship, the daily striving to change, to let go and receive more. It didn't happen overnight. It takes years of practice, a lifetime. I am not a saint, but I claim, accept, and am grateful for my spiritual and healthy emotional progress. Charlie made some very important discoveries in his journey. In the context of surrender, which we are discussing here, the first thing he discovered was that he needed to be willing to make a choice. It was up to Charlie to put his will into action and to choose to work the steps and to practice being willing until he was entirely willing. The next thing he discovered was that his own resistance to surrendering was because his self-concept was that his personality was his character defects. If he gave up his shortcomings, he'd become the hole in the donut. Believing there's something more and better is the essence of faith. It is trusting that God will reshape me into what I was meant to be in the first place, a decent human being. How many times have we heard that at meetings? Probably many, many times. We fear becoming invisible if we stop practicing our faults. Moreover, we fear becoming average, normal, or boring. In contemplating surrender, many of us come face to face with our self-image in an honest fashion for the first time. We may have glimpsed it in step 5, which can be a very difficult realization. We spend a lifetime building an image of who we are and how we operate, a fantasy story. Then we are asked to put it aside when it is in conflict with the new principles we've decided to follow in the program. No wonder we have fear and misgivings. Here is where we must rethink the nature of our true, authentic selves and whom we would become, our willingness to go to any length for recovery. It is an act of will, a choice. And we must be willing to assume accountability for that choice. Steps 6 and 7 do not say whom we would become, but who we don't want to be. It is very threatening to the ideas we've held about ourselves when we must choose whom we would become. Our defects, many times, are our best friends. If I become, choose to be, entirely ready, and my character defects lessen or disappear, whom will I be? As it says in the 12 and 12, it is not the blatantly obvious character defects that we have problems giving up. It is the ones we practice in moderation or only on occasion that are the most difficult. What appear to be natural instinctual drives seem to become our enemies when we start to contemplate and prepare to work step 6. In becoming entirely ready, in deciding to be willing to surrender, we must examine our hearts and work with prayer and meditation to set aside self-image and move into self-awareness. Let's take a look at Pat's story. When I was about 3 years into recovery, I had a real crisis of faith. I didn't feel I was moving and changing enough in the program, and I wasn't confident that the people who were saying not to worry about becoming the hole in the donut had enough of what I wanted to be trustworthy. I went outside the program for help through therapy and came face to face with a counselor who told me I needed to rework my third step. That was the last thing I wanted to hear. He also got me thinking about step 6 and 7. I was afraid of losing those things that made me, me. Would I give up my intensity and aggressiveness? Would I lose my edge? Would I become spiritual and monk-like? How would I handle life without some of my more important pieces? It caused me a great deal of discomfort and occasionally some outright fear. In working through some of these issues with my sponsor and talking about them in meetings, I began to realize that the things that make me who I am are not defined by my actions. I wasn't just attending meetings anymore to avoid doing what I needed doing outside of meetings. All my defects become glaringly obvious through my actions, but that does not define me as a person. I may act badly on occasion. That doesn't make me a bad person. I started looking at giving up and releasing those parts of me, those habits of action that were defective and self-defeating. Finally, I was working on the steps outside of meetings instead of just talking about them at meetings. I saw my character defects as glitches to be corrected rather than major portions of my framework. Sometimes it felt pretty major. But as I learned to surrender and release, how I defined myself began to change too. Now I seek the opportunity to look at defects and let them go. Something new and better always seems available to take their place. Over the years in recovery, I have slowly developed a deep belief that I can solve the problems and find the willingness to do so. It becomes apparent in Pat's story, and many like it, that the hole in the donut fear is a shadow boxer. It can cause us alarm, but if we do the work and move forward, it gradually disappears in the light. It disappears in proportion to our understanding of who our higher power is and how the God of our understanding works in our lives. Pat also brought up a point about trust. We will look very closely at trust when we get into the 7th step. For now, it is enough to say that trust is an ongoing issue with almost everyone in recovery. We'll take a look now at ways of taking action and those things that cause us to resist taking action to become entirely ready. Action. For many of us, working the steps has meant going to meetings and talking about the steps and what they've meant in our lives, or working the steps so we can talk about them in meetings. Occasionally, we've been forced into taking action, like doing a 4th step inventory or talking out a 5th step. Making amends calls for action. Usually, however, after taking those particular actions, we're done. Steps 6 and 7 in particular become nodders. We go to meetings where 6 and 7 are discussed and nod wisely and serenely with almost every comment that is made. When it is our turn to talk, we explain about getting into the 6th and 7th after doing our inventory and taking a 5th step. We all feel like we're working the steps. It is a challenge to take another look at that process. Talking about the steps at meetings is much different than working them. Remember that chapter 6 in the big book where these steps are outlined is called Into Action. Having done a little work or action on a step in the past is a far cry from continuing to work it now. Nodding at meetings in agreement with a particularly profound comment is not the same as doing what the speaker may have done to reach that awareness. We must become willing to take action, continuous action, to become who we can become. It takes awareness to become entirely ready. Slow down, stop doing, and be. Feel it. Here's Richard's perspective on step 6. I had enjoyed many rewards from the program, experienced many of the feelings of liberation my sponsor had promised, and after 2 years of working the steps, something was still missing. There remained lingering feelings of discontent. The personality flaws I had uncovered in doing the fourth and fifth had diminished, but were still there. They produced thoughts and feelings I had while using impatience, intolerance, quick temper, arrogance, and especially an unforgiving attitude toward others and myself. So I had lunch with my sponsor and discussed my situation with him. After talking a while and asking many questions, he asked, "You really think you've done all the steps, don't you?" I assured him, somewhat indignantly, that I had. Hadn't I done the fourth and fifth with him? Had he not seen my 12th step actively with his own eyes? Wasn't he aware of how faithfully, in my mind, I was doing the 10th and 11th steps? "All very true," he said. "But what about the 6th step?" He went on by telling me a story. One night there was a man down on his hands and knees looking frantically for something on the sidewalk under a street lamp. A police officer stopped by and asked him what he was doing. "I've lost my keys," answered the man. "Will you help me look for them?" The police officer joined in and after a while asked, "Are you sure you dropped them here?" The man looked up and said, "No, I dropped them back there. But there it is much too dark." The police officer asked, "Why are we looking here then?" With all sincerity, the man answered, "Because here is where the light is, and I'm afraid of the dark." Finished with the story, my sponsor again asked, "What about the 6th step?" I was shocked he could ask me such a question. Of course, I was willing to change and have my higher power remove my defects of character, wasn't I? Was I? If I was sincerely willing to change, why did I remain so much the same? I realized that perhaps I had been paying lip service to the 6th step. Compared to most of the other steps, the 6th appeared simple. I believed this because no overt action seemed required. There is none of the dramatic confrontation that exists when we do the 9th step, nor is there the feeling of accomplishment that comes with helping others in the 12th. The 6th is not dramatic. There are no enthusiastic witnesses to rush up and shake one's hand. It's a rather solitary affair and hence seems simple. But had I taken any action? The 6th step means facing ourselves, and that is usually more difficult than being honest with another person. I have found it difficult to lie to others because of practicing the principles of the program, but still easy to lie to myself. When I say all too swiftly, "Of course I'm willing to change," I know I will ask myself, "Really? Who's kidding whom?" The fact that I will daily question my willingness to change will increase my ability to be increasingly willing. I simply won't take the process as lightly as I have before. I can't learn anything unless I'm sincerely willing to learn. Nor will making myself promises to change have any significance until the willingness factor is developed. My sponsor intervened again with a few of his pointed questions. "You played football in school, didn't you?" he asked, knowing full well I had. He reminded me that I told him I hated the practice, getting those bumps and bruises for no good reason. He also reminded me how I had said I loved the actual game, especially the cheers when I did something very well. "You know," he said, "no one gets excited about practice. It has no flash to it. It's the game that counts. But a good game performance requires hard practice, and the 6th step can be compared with football practice. If you're going to make continuing progress in the program, you really have to work the 6th and 7th steps. You can't stand around on one foot waiting for applause. There won't be any if you don't keep practicing." What my sponsor told me that day still carries an important moral lesson. It's one I'm continually, diligently learning because I now, finally, am seeing the true value in the 6th step. Like the man looking for his keys in the wrong place, I too was looking in the wrong place to become entirely ready in the 6th step. I'm making progress in facing my fears and venturing into the dark of my unwillingness to have my character defects removed. I am continually repeating the rather paradoxical sentence I came up with that helps me with how I look at the 6th step. The fact that I will daily question my willingness to change will increase my ability to be increasingly willing. It is important to discuss another aspect of recovery to gain what may be for us a new perspective. If we think that recovery is strictly about abstinence from alcohol, or drugs, food, sex, gambling, and so on, and that staying abstinent will solve all the major problems in life, then we probably won't want to hear what comes next. If, on the other hand, we feel that recovery is about living fully, usefully, and freely, and about reaching toward our potential, then we might keep an open ear. A person who was not in recovery mentioned an observation he had made about folks in recovery. He felt that recovering people spent almost all their time learning to stand up and helping others stand up, but very few spent any time walking. If walking in this analogy means getting on with a meaningful and purposeful life, there is some truth in his observation. We get so caught up in our own abstinence or going to meetings and helping others recover that we lose sight of the larger picture. Sure, there is great meaning in helping others recover. Helping others is a great way to move into humility, which we will discuss in depth in the section on Step 7, and to gain a spiritual perspective on life. Helping others to stand, however, is not quite as meaningful as helping others learn to walk, nor is it as meaningful as helping others find a direction and destination to walk toward. We help others by setting the example rather than telling them the example. We learn to shift our vision to the horizon rather than watch our feet. This is extremely important when we are looking to continue to grow and to let go of those things that may limit our ability to do so. The first act is awareness. Second is acceptance. Then third is surrender, action. Once we have chosen to be willing to surrender, we move on to those things that can help our surrendering and our awareness of what it is we're giving up. The choice to surrender, the becoming entirely ready, is just that, a choice. Awareness, however, is an entirely different matter. To make surrender effective, we must be willing to help the process by using our awareness to move into line with the surrender. We must choose to act as if. Our awareness must shift so we become aware when we aren't acting in accordance with that choice. Changing our awareness can be a slow process, or it can be instantaneous. With grace, it can happen smoothly and quickly. When we are struggling, it can seem to take forever. The difference is willingness. When we stay honest, willing, and especially open-minded, we stay aware. Lisa adds how acting as if helped her with the sixth step. My sponsor gave me a typed piece of paper and told me to put it on my bathroom mirror and read it daily. That piece of paper said, "In the arena of human life, the honors and rewards fall to those who show their good qualities in action." I did as my sponsor suggested, and that sentence staring at me all the time has helped me with my continuing readiness. The good character qualities I want to have are only demonstrated to me and others by my actions. But the only way for me to get there, to get what I needed, was to act as if I had it. The key word is act. I have discovered in my case that knowledge often follows action rather than vice versa. When I faked it in my early days, I found myself making it in later days. In the beginning, I was asked to act as if I was following instructions, trusting the program, listening to my sponsor, and coming to believe. The amazing thing was that soon I was doing those very things. I was never able to think my way into recovery. My mind created a tremendous amount of trouble for me. I needed to turn my mind down, not off. I soon discovered the difference between doing and thinking. The key to acting as if is faith. The way to faith is through my fears. I have made progress and stay entirely ready when I turn fears over to my faith and simply act as if. As we discussed, acting as if can seem to be in conflict with being genuine and authentic. However, when we are willing, making choices to make positive progress and to have God shape us toward our potential as spiritual beings, then acting in accordance with those intentions is genuine in spite of our real feelings. One of the things we must be careful of is our capacity for drama. It seems as if addiction is a path toward drama. Perhaps because most of us repressed and suppressed feelings from the very beginning, we learned to be dramatic when it was important for our feelings to be noticed. We also learned to be dramatic to hide our true feelings, even from ourselves. Even though it is important to validate, feel, and identify our feelings, we must be careful not to dramatize. When we are moving toward becoming entirely ready, it is easy to be self-absorbed and dramatic about our path. We must be willing to quietly move toward self-examination rather than self-absorption. As we practice, this difference becomes more evident. Ritual prayer, meditation, and cleansing are four things we can do to make the process of self-examination move more quickly and easily. 1. Find a ritual. We can develop or borrow a ritual to mark our surrender and choice to become ready. The power of ritual is incredible, and we can use that power to help us move into balance with our choice. Think about a candle ceremony, perhaps burning slips of paper with our hesitations and fears and character defects written on them. Or walk on the beach and write in the sand at the water's edge all the things that concern and trouble us about surrendering. Then watch the waves erase the words and our cares. Perhaps put our thoughts and fears and feelings on slips of papers in bottles and set them sailing into the sunset at the ocean. Or ask a sponsor. Or ask at meetings. Read about rituals and borrow one that feels good and significant to us, or make up a simple, powerful ritual marking our decision to become entirely ready. Rituals are rites of passage, as is the sixth step. Using a ritual for this powerful method of transformation personalizes the experience. Let's hear from Betty. I have attacked step six many times. It has attacked me in return. We have had open warfare and we have had peace. For periods of time, I have on purpose ignored this step. I have said that it made no sense to me. The battle began some years back when I regularly attended step discussion meetings. I had done my best on the first five steps, I thought. I had even made a written list of all my defects. They counted up to 30. Following the example of an old-timer friend of mine, whose quality of recovery I admired, I printed in ink each of my separate defects on a poker chip. Then all 30 chips went into a small pitcher. Every morning upon awakening, I plunged my hand into it, like picking a number from a goldfish bowl, and came up with the chip for today. The defect might be anger, fear, pride, resentment, gossip, arrogance, self-pity, procrastination, anxiety, intolerance, and so on. But whichever one it was had to be concentrated on for the next 24 hours and either reduced to a minimum or cast away. It was a kind of game. I enjoyed wrestling with one defect a day. I felt I was making progress, really working the program. It hadn't occurred to me that I had gone overboard on this defect business. 30, indeed. How is that for the pride defect? Of course, most of them were not serious flaws of character, such as the inability to be honest with oneself. Most were bad habits possessed in some degree by most humans. Nevertheless, I kept up this game for 2 or 3 years, telling many fellow members about it and urging them to go and do likewise. I explained that, although the step suggests that God would remove these defects when and if I became ready to let go of them, I was of the school that believed in the saying, "Pray for potatoes, but pick up the hoe." I did ask my higher power to lend a hand on the defect I happened to confront each day, but I felt that God expected me to use energy on rooting it out of my character all by myself. Still, those dozens of defects I had laid claim to kept cropping up again and again, over and over. It seemed that the harder I fought them, the harder they fought back. I became very discouraged. I decided I had been willing, I had tried, and I would now let number six and myself have a vacation. I put the little pitcher with its chips on the shelf behind some books, and only now and then dipped into it. I kept busy and active in the program. I felt comfortable in recovery. I was trying to practice the principles in all my affairs. Then, out of nowhere, came a deep resentment toward a fellow member. I agonized over it, prayed over it, but discussed it with no one. I had insomnia, indigestion, and fatigue. Any good doctor can tell you that negative emotions make people physically ill. Fortunately, just about that time, our group was slated for discussion of Step 6. I opened my copy of the 12 and 12 and read the step all the way through. Although I had read it many times before, it seemed as if I saw its meaning for the first time. I gathered that, instead of fighting mightily against a defect, I also had to let go of it. Just simply open my hands, my heart, and my mind, and say to my higher power, "Here it is, this defect. I give it to you. Please remove it from me." In this case, it was the bitter and destructive resentment that I wished to be rid of. And so it happened. It faded away and never returned. Since then, I have followed the same procedure on other emotional problems with the same result. I just have to keep in mind that if I am not 100% sincere in my willingness to be rid of the problem, the procedure won't work. I have come to realize that step six means exactly what it says, no more, no less. When and if I become ready to have painful, inhibiting, or long-standing flaws removed, they will be. Not always permanently, and not all of them. Some are always on standby. But if and when they return, they will be weaker and much easier to let go. As for all those bad habits I once listed as defects, I am trying to arrest them one day at a time as I do my addiction. A little progress has been made on pride. I can now admit that most of my troubles stem from one large and glaring defect, self-centeredness. For how can I wallow in self-pity, weep over resentments, be sick with righteous anger, ache with envy, and tense up with fears and anxieties unless all my thoughts are exclusively on poor me? A long time ago, a very wise person wrote, "A person's life is what his thoughts make it." Through step 6, I have learned how true that is. I may never comprehend the saying fully, yet I know its value to me. It calls forth the most precious asset any recovering person can have, the willingness to get out of the driver's seat, to stop trying to run the show. I need to keep the 6th and 7th step message of letting go and letting God in my thoughts at all times. 2. Use prayer. Our ritual can include prayer. Our daily meditation and practice can include prayer. We'll also talk about prayer in connection with the 7th step, but it is essential in the 6th. As in all the steps, prayer as a part of ritual is doubly potent and can add depth and meaning to any commitment we decide to make, for example, willingness to be or stay willing. Use prayer to ask for awareness and willingness to receive. Use prayer to ask for depth and clarity. Use prayer to ask to become a better channel for our higher power. Use prayer to ask for ease and grace in surrender. Use prayer to ask how to pray. Use prayer to ask how to think and act. Use prayer to say thank you. Use prayer. Prayer can be considered cheating because of how much easier it makes the process go. Prayer is of no use when it is not used. Prayer is not only a matter of belief, it is a matter of practice. We can't get caught in the trap of dogma or method. Prayer is not about right or wrong, or should or only. It is about a personal or individualized way to talk with God, or our higher power, or universal energy, or the collective unconscious, or whatever we want to call it. Prayer is not about someone telling us how to pray or what to say. It is about communication. There are some extremely effective prayers from many spiritual traditions. These prayers became effective because the people who wrote them or said them practiced them daily. The saints who used prayer were not worried about doing it right. They were concerned about communicating with God and gaining clarity for their own action. We continually need to take a closer look at prayer and its place in our life. It can be revealing. Many members become boosters of prayer only after having resisted using it. It just didn't seem necessary or even admirable to them. People who needed and used prayer seemed to be a rung lower on the ladder than those who could get things done. Self-will versus God's will. It was only after getting involved in prayer through a spiritual search and surrender, then practicing it, that we come to understand its depth and meaning. Prayer is not something to be intellectualized and analyzed. It can only be realized through practice. The program urges us to take action. Pray. An often quoted prayer goes like this. God, give me the courage and strength to know who I really am, to act accordingly in my life, and to refrain from diverting my time, energy, and interest into my character defects. Prayer is a Special Time by Chris. Prayer is a special time I share with God. Prayer is the means I use to talk with God and listen as God communicates with me. When I pray, I become still and I quiet any unrest within me. I reaffirm my oneness with my higher power, and I find the answers I seek. I do not limit my prayers to a certain time or a particular place. Whenever a small success enters my life or a moment of joy illuminates my day, I silently thank God for those blessings. Every time I affirm God as the source of my good and give thanks for the many channels through which it comes, I am praying to God. Prayer enables me to know and feel that I am a beloved child of God. I am needed because I can be an expression of good in my world. I am a useful person. 3. Learn to meditate. Meditation and prayer are traditionally discussed in the 11th step, but we can put them to use here if we choose. Those in the program for a while realize that the steps are synergistic. and that after a while they will be practicing parts of one with many others, all at the same time. Meditation is a practice that can be utilized throughout the whole program. Meditation is mostly about listening and quieting our mind, quiet time. Although not much is said in the Big Book or the 12 and 12 about how to meditate, we are instructed to practice and become intuitive to the presence of God. We practice meditation as a discipline in our own way until we have made it a regular part of our routine. Some members benefit by reading books about meditation and its methods. Others have attended classes at their local community college, yoga center, or church. Just as with prayer and other positive disciplines in recovery, the benefits of meditation only become apparent through practice. In using meditation for the sixth step, a form of contemplation can be used. Taking a single word or thought and letting it run through our mind can be very revealing. Take, for example, the word surrender. We may start by repeating the word in our mind over and over. Surrender, 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 surrender. Give up, release, let go. Surrender, peace, renewal. Surrender, vulnerable, open. Surrender, surrender, strength, change, higher power. Surrender. We can keep the string of thoughts going for a while, probably no more than 5 minutes to start as we do our regular morning or evening routine of prayer and meditation. Prayer is seeing answers and direction in life. Meditation is listening for answers from a higher power and developing the ability within ourselves to accept the answers. Reflection is the study of ways to turn the answers we get from prayer and meditation into action. Reflection is the study of meaning and uses of the 12 steps. It is not a snap judgment. It requires consideration of the pros and cons of our possible choices and determination of what directions we will take to give us the best results. The progress of spirituality from prayer to meditation to reflection is active, not passive. It is taking part in the joy of putting the results of prayer and meditation into action. We learn through times of quiet reflection to work into our lives the answers our higher power has given us as a result of our prayer and meditation. Prayer, meditation, and reflection will also give us greater awareness of our particular forms of resistance. This knowledge lets us know how we are doing it wrong, such as finding out our shoelaces aren't tied together so we can tie them. In this type of contemplation, a new awareness and focus will arise. If we are uncomfortable with traditional meditation and prayer, we may try learning some simple practices of quieting the mind and gaining concentration. We use our intuition and sense of higher purpose to find a comfortable method to practice becoming entirely ready. We gain clarity and vision. Whatever method we use, meditation helps determine the shape of our prayer and the direction of our surrender. Gino shares some ideas on meditation. All of us are God's children, made extraordinary by the gifts He has given us. Foremost is the chance of a new life, one of sobriety and cleanliness, one day at a time. God has chosen us for a special purpose. Here, in this school of life, He is at work, bending, shaping, and molding us for one purpose only, and that is to, by our actions and example, be useful to others and ourselves. He will do with us what He has never done with us before. He is doing with us what He is not doing with anyone else. We are special in His eyes, and we should let Him have His way. To accept this change in direction and have the strength to carry out these new actions, we need the 11th step as our key to maintaining our conscious contact, which takes away the regrets of the past and the fears of tomorrow and allows us to deal with the challenges of today. A quiet time of prayer and meditation with our higher power every morning before the daily toil and common challenges of the world begin will put us in a positive attitude for the day. Those of us who choose to develop a close relationship with our higher power find that the answers we receive, or sometimes what we call the intuitive knowledge, help us maintain our daily commitments. We must learn to turn down our minds, open up our hearts, and give ourselves to our God in quiet times. This seems difficult at first, but discipline over self-will, although it may be slow, comes with practice, and practicing regularly is necessary in making the best use of the 11th step. 4. Prepare for cleansing. If we are to engage in a new course of action and become entirely ready to get rid of our defects, it makes sense that we start from a clean slate. Of course, common sense is a very rare thing in or out of the program, So it is not surprising that it is rarely discussed in meetings that we might need to make an effort to get to a clean place. Let's take a look at a few areas that we may want to examine and clean up as we prepare to become entirely ready. How is our language used? Are we gaining maturity? Do we swear a lot and make crude remarks about the opposite sex and use biased and prejudiced language? Do we gossip? Are we sarcastic? Do we tell dirty or risque jokes? Do we use violent language? We take a look at our language and see how it fits in with the spiritual approach to living and to becoming entirely ready. When we first start attending meetings, many of us are amazed at the amount of swearing that occurs. Smoking, swearing, and making fun of those less fortunate seem to be accepted things. We need to examine this closely. How does a person who has taken a third step and is practicing and preparing for steps 6 and 7 talk? Try giving up swearing. Try giving up violent language. Try giving up bias. Try giving up sexism. Try giving up gossip. We become willing to give them up and act as if until God removes them. Another area to look at closely is all other addictive practices. Language patterns can be addictive. Do we still smoke, binge on sugar, excessively drink coffee, recklessly gamble, abuse credit cards, act out sexually, drive over the speed limit, and so on? How do these activities affect our movement toward God and spirituality? Does practicing one addiction mean that we still have an addictive lifestyle? Remember what it says in the big book about alcohol, drugs, food, sex, gambling, and so on, being a symptom. It is just the tip of the iceberg. We need to closely examine our whole lives for addictive and abusive patterns. If we are to give up our defects of character, we need to become willing to see them all. We examine our sexual life and how we relate to the opposite sex, or the same sex if that is our preference. Do we still treat others as sex objects? Do we use sex to alter our mood? Are we abusive? Are we able to be intimate? Can we reveal our true feelings in an open and trusting manner? Can we relate well with those we are sexually attracted to without becoming sexual? What is the pattern in our relationships? Are we addicted to caffeine or gum or any substance? It is very interesting when we start to judge those things we deem to be less threatening to our sobriety and therefore okay to keep. We really start to rationalize and explain. The fact is that these substances are addictive, period. We can't afford to kid ourselves about that any more than we can about smoking, drinking, gambling, sexing, or any other addictions. All addictions mask feelings and change the way we deal with ourselves and others. We need to deal with them all. How about our work patterns? Are we a workaholic? Do we avoid our family and other issues by working tremendously long hours? Do we rationalize the time spent away from home with the explanation that we need to work this hard to keep our job? Economically, times are hard. So do we need to put in the extra effort in order to remain secure? Do we gain the major satisfaction and meaning from life through our work? Are we willing to look at how we work? Are we completely identified by the results of our work? Work is an area that many of us are afraid to examine. We might find that we use work to alter our mood. We might find that we use work to avoid things. We might find that work is much more than a job. Our work life is worth examining. How about exercise? Do we use exercise to alter our mood? Do we become addicted to exercise and the results of exercise? Do we avoid things through exercise? Like work, this is a tough one to examine. We all need to exercise, so how much is too much? That is why we are taking a close look now. With prayer and meditation, we hope to find a balance point that is in line with our spiritual intent and our ability to share. Let's look at cleansing to move toward becoming ready. The first cleansing action is to examine what we eat and drink. Pick a day. Use the day to examine eating habits and drinking habits. We look at how we eat foods and at our eating rituals. The second cleansing action suggested is to make a special retreat, maybe for a weekend, at least for a day, to practice our examinations and cleansing rituals and to look at becoming entirely ready. Maybe we can go to the mountains or the beach. Maybe a friend has a cabin or summer home we can borrow. It should be a place away from our normal routine where we can be quiet and contemplative. Use the retreat to become as open as possible to all the actions necessary to becoming entirely ready. Another cleansing action many find helpful is to make a day of silence. Don't speak for 24 hours. Don't listen to the radio or stereo. Don't watch TV. Don't read or clean house. Don't distract yourself with any diversions. Just be quiet and open. Let the world enter you quietly. Contemplate this quote by Publilius. I have often regretted my speech, never my silence. The next cleansing action suggested is a period of celibacy. We take some time, a week or more, to examine our sexual patterns and relationship patterns. We learn to become open to relating in a non-sexual manner. We take a close look at our own sexuality and how comfortable we are with it. Be open to our intuition and our spirituality and our sexual life. The last cleansing action suggested is to release the clutter in our life. We take a look in our storage areas and garage. We get rid of the stuff we've been packing around for years every time we move. We give it to a charitable organization. We take a look in our closets. Possibly if we haven't worn it in a year or a year and a half, we give it away. The point is, we quit holding on to things that are useless to us. They may be very important to someone else who will use or wear them. We clean up our house or apartment. Those things we don't use but have been holding on to just in case are let go. Release them. This way we make room in our life for new and exciting things. This is more than just a physical act. It is symbolic of opening our life mentally, emotionally, spiritually for new things. It is very hard to reach for new adventures and growth in our lives when our hands are full, holding on to the baggage and excesses of our past. We are grateful for what we have in our life, taking nothing for granted, releasing what we can, getting ready to become more and less and better. Judith shares a story of her attempts to deal with clutter. The first time my sponsor visited my apartment, she was taken aback by how messy it was. She went on and on about the importance of keeping my place clean and how a messy place had a dramatic effect, possibly more on an unconscious level, on my general outlook on life and recovery. I told her I just couldn't seem to keep my apartment in order, which resulted in living in a mess all the time. I related feebly that I had turned the problem over to my higher power and I had been praying to have God clean my home. Of course, I had been mistaken then about the role of my higher power in my recovery. Then I went through the being stuck on the third step phase, where if my living space is messy, it must be God's will that I live in a mess. My sponsor and I had a good laugh about my first two attempts to deal with my messy apartment and how these ideas typically visit most of us in recovery as we make progress in understanding how the steps work in our lives. I now know that if I don't want to live in a mess, I need to pray to God for the willingness, courage, and motivation to clean up my own mess. If we think of any other areas in our life that we'd like to be able to have a clearer understanding of, we can design a cleansing exercise to gain a new perspective. There is no better time than now to look at all the troubled areas in our life. We get ready to make over all those areas so that we become willing to examine them. Here is an example from Pam. 5 years into recovery, I noticed that my spiritual life, my life in general, seemed empty and less than it could be. My marriage was not in trouble, but it was not a vibrant, joyful joining together of two people in love. My job was a job, full of stress, lots of demands, little satisfaction, and I seemed to be spending more and more time doing it. I had friends and activities, but had little time to give to them, and little time, it seemed, to give to myself. At the suggestion of my sponsor, I decided to go on a retreat. I reserved a cabin on a remote island. It was an old yoga retreat with hot springs and a small waterfall, close to a state park with a mountain full of paths to walk. It seemed ideal. I took time off from work, about 4 days. I decided to do the retreat during the week as I didn't want to take time away from my family. I went to the cabin. There was no TV or radio. There were no regular distractions. I decided to remain silent for the 4 days. I read and contemplated. I got up early every morning and meditated. I walked up the mountain at least once a day. I did exercises where I examined each part of my life up to this point. How did I use language? How did I like my work? What was I going to do in the future? What kind of wife was I, and how was I going to change and improve? What was I doing to take care of my body, my mind, my spirit? I fasted for a day, then I ate only healthy vegetarian meals. I stayed away from other people and just maintained my integrity unto myself. I got in touch with me again. I liked most of what I found. Some things I found I needed to change. Some things I noticed for the first time. I came back from my retreat ready to make things happen in every area of my life and ready to let things happen as they would. The last area we may wish to take a look at concerning step 6 is the 7 deadly defects or the 7 deadly sins. We've discussed some of these defects in other contexts, and it is worth reviewing those and adding more while we look at some areas that have troubled people from the beginning of recorded history. The first of the 7 deadly sins is pride, excessive belief in one's own abilities. Our society is very confused about pride. Religion teaches us that pride goes before the fall. Psychology teaches us that a healthy sense of pride is essential for full functioning in the world. The program teaches us that the misuse of pride and the misapplication of pride have been part of the biggest cause of our problems. It is no wonder that we have mixed feelings and thoughts about pride. With all the current interest in self-esteem and self-worth, there is another element to think about when we consider pride. Some of us come from families where we were not taught healthy emotional language and habits. We did not get a balanced perspective of the world and relationships, and some of us got a distorted view of where we stood in relation to the rest of the world. We felt, and many of us still do, less than. In order to make up for that, we learn to exaggerate and lie and blow our accomplishments way out of proportion in order to feel of some value. To succeed, we have to stop thinking we are less than other people. We tell ourselves we are not unworthy, inadequate, or unable to cope fully with life's problems. We begin to see the glass as half full instead of half empty. We have to get rid of feelings of inability before we can make progress. As we learn more about how false pride has held us back from our full potential, we remember if we change our thoughts, we can change ourselves. Our main problem centers in our mind rather than our body. Many of us still think our value as a human being is in what we do or what we don't do rather than who we are. We think our value is about results, the car we drive, the person we marry, the house we live in, the job we have, the vacation we take, the clothes we wear. We've shifted the emphasis from who to what. Taking a look at pride means gaining a new perspective and looking again at who we are, not exclusively at what we have or do. Some of us have heard the slogan, "The only person keeping us from having self-worth is ourselves." The willingness to work the 6th step on pride begins by understanding that having healthy pride in our accomplishments in life is fine, as long as it is coupled with humility and gratitude. As long as we don't settle for an inferior quality of recovery and continue to strive for the best, that kind of pride will not cause harm. However, out-of-control pride is dangerous. Too many people are certain they wrote the book. They take false pride in their accomplishments and feel they have nothing left to learn. They are eager to tell everyone how much they know. This is a sure way of closing a mind that desperately needs to be wide open. This kind of pride has turned into arrogance and turns many people off. False pride and settling for inferiority will accomplish nothing. We no longer choose to have low self-worth or settle for less than. What value do I have as a human being? What do I have to offer to others in the way of service, wisdom, and help? Who have I become, and who am I becoming in order to increase my value to the rest of humankind and myself? The thought that must go with us constantly is, how can I best serve you? Your will be done, not mine. We will talk about humility in relation to pride in the 7th step. Right now, it is important to examine how we define ourselves. What criteria do we use to say who we are? Hi, my name is blank, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, my name is blank, and I'm a doctor. Hi, my name is blank, and I'm interested in spiritual growth and becoming my potential. How do we define ourselves? That will say a lot about where we place pride in our lives. Finally, we are reminded that pride is not to be feared. Although pride is listed at the top of the list of 7 deadly sins, the sin is having arrogance or false pride. Healthy pride is a necessary part of self-esteem and character growth. To repeat, our program teaches us that the pride that goes before a fall is an unhealthy state, a symptom of character defects of egotism, grandiosity, and arrogance. No harm will come to spiritual growth from the pride experience when we freely admit to ourselves that any progress of ours was not made by us alone. Humble pride acknowledges the guidance of others and a faith in a higher power whom we call upon for inspiration and motivation. With humility and God's help, we learn to have healthy pride in our good works, progress and growth in recovery. The second defect is envy, the desire for others' traits, status, abilities, or situation. Envy is a form of fear. Just like pride, envy has a lot to do with results, other people's. We envy the things, jobs, friends, relationships, status, and just about everything else that someone else has. We are taught to envy by advertisers and the media. We must keep up with the Joneses. We must live the lifestyle as shown in the beer commercials. We have to have the newest and the best and the biggest and the brightest. We fear we won't get the good things and resent when others do. Part of having things is the believable lie that external things make us okay. If we have all these nice things, we must be okay, right? So, if we don't have them, something is wrong, and we better get moving. Even more important, we must envy and feel bad about the people who have what we want. They obviously don't deserve it the way we do. They must be drug dealers or liars and cheaters. Otherwise, how could they have what we want and deserve, and yet we didn't get it, and they did? As we aim toward a lasting and comfortable willingness to change by using the sixth step, we find that envy is also a mask for jealousy. And jealousy is combined with other character defects such as self-will, dishonesty, hatred, selfishness, and resentment. Jealousy is a great danger in recovery. The kind of thinking that causes jealousy makes us believe that the world owes us much more than we are able to earn by our own best efforts. To repeat, when we envy others for what they own, for their standing in the community, or for the people who care about them, we are on our way to self-pity. This state of mind produces not only jealousy, reactive depression, and an attitude that life's not fair, but also anger against the world. Soon, that jealousy and anger turn against those people most dear to us. We are reminded that the Big Book calls jealousy that most terrible of human emotions. Envy is very much caught up in desire. We are taught desire rather than deserve. Just because we want it must mean we are able to get it, right? The universe operates on a deserve principle. You will reap what you sow. Yet we are taught if we just want it badly enough, something will happen so we can get it. No wonder we become frustrated and depressed. Just affirm it enough in your life and it will manifest. Wrong. The same rules operate for everyone. We can get almost anything we need in life. We can't realistically get everything we want. We must learn to be selective and to work for what we want. Sow the seeds and the plants will grow. The more seeds we plant, the more will grow, given proper nurturing, care, sunlight, water, and soil. But we only have time to plant so many seeds, and God plays a part in the weather and soil. Just as in the sixth and seventh steps, God's part is as important as our part. We must do the work. God provides the environment and opportunity, and the power, direction, willingness, and the teachers. If envy is a big part of our life, we take a look at how selective we've been and how we sow. We need to plant the seeds before we expect to harvest. We need to take a look to see if we are able to celebrate the accomplishments and victories of others. Do we feel good for someone else's triumph? We hope so. That is a big step on the path past envy. We are reminded of the age-old wisdom, there is not a passion so strongly rooted in the human heart as envy. In the past, when we drank, used, or misbehaved, our self-worth was beaten down to the point of feeling inferior to those around us. We wallowed in our character defects of worthlessness, awkwardness, sadness, and self-pity. We were envious of those who had what we wanted. Envy brought hatred, jealousy, anger, fear, disrespect, and distrust. We wished failure and disaster on people who had become successful or who had gained in any way. Before the program, many of us wanted what others had, but we didn't know how to get it. Now we're happy with the miracles we receive in recovery. We have discovered that doing is more important than having, and experiencing is more important than possessing. The willingness to work on our character defect of envy produces that positive practice of having more compassion, empathy, and love. The next defect is gluttony, consuming more than required. Many of us do not balance our dietary habits. Many of us are addicted to sugar and carbohydrates. We binge and diet and binge and diet. We have eating problems. We are greedy in our eating habits, which affects our health. We've not examined the mix of exercise, nutrition, and spirit that is necessary to formulate a plan for living that provides energy, health, strength, and endurance. We have sloppy habits of taking care of this temple of the spirit. If we are greedy, we are never satisfied. It is important to put all our habits into the context of becoming entirely ready. If we overlook one little addiction, or one little bad habit, or one little defect, are we just a little addictive? How can we claim abstinence if we still hold other addictive habits or character defects? It is important that we realize that the sixth and seventh steps are not just about alcohol or drugs or overeating or gambling or sexing. They are about putting our lives in alignment. How honestly we work these steps is in direct proportion to our desire for positive change. No holding back. Please be willing to take a look at it all. The next habit to examine is sloth, avoidance of physical or spiritual work, which is spiritual procrastination in all areas of our life. We hear that procrastination is the art of keeping up with yesterday. Many of us were constant procrastinators before we began our 12-step program. Addiction created the habit of delay because as long as we had our substance or destructive behavior, everything else could wait. Now we know that action is truly the magic word. The slogan, "Easy does it," doesn't mean we put things off. It means to do it, but to do it in our higher power's good time. Slow growth, slowly making progress with our defects of character, doesn't mean postponement. We can't put off airing problems to other people for fear of being ridiculed. We need answers early during our progress. When we attempt to ask for solutions, we can be clear and direct in our questions. We know our friends will always give us the right to be wrong and quickly correct faulty thinking. We can work through our character defects just by pressing on. We do today what we are meant to do today. Many of us think we have no problem in this area because we work hard at our jobs. How lazy are we in our relationships? What kind of load do we carry around the house? How about our spiritual practice? Are we carrying our load there? Do we put in the time and effort to grow and expand? Or do we just pay it lip service, if that? What about the other areas of our life? Are we continuing to grow mentally, emotionally, physically? Do we practice disciplines and put out the effort to make our time count? Sloth is the thief of time. The character defect of putting off actions until things get better is one of the most destructive detours we can make. Delays never make problems go away. They only make success harder to attain. If we shy away from bringing out our problems to others, we are sure to cause stress and misunderstanding. Quite often, postponing facing up to reality results from fear that others will laugh at us. This is self-pity in action. Solutions come from direct and specific action. We always remember that others in our group give us the right to be wrong, knowing that a change in direction is always possible for anyone with problems. Procrastination wastes precious time. When we procrastinate and delay working our sixth and seventh steps, we are only making sure our problems will get worse. We remember that solutions come from taking action. Sloth is not just about results, it is about effort. Do we give full effort to everything we do? It is definitely worth looking at in our lives. "I'll do it tomorrow" is a habit that leaves us always behind schedule. If yesterday's work is only getting done today, then how can today's work get done? It has to wait, of course, until tomorrow. Can we catch up? No. We are in the habit of procrastinating. We have a black cloud over our head made up of guilt, anxiety, and worry. A feeling of failure creeps in. In the program, it's a day at a time. We try to do today's work today. What if we put off the first step of the work? Nothing will give us satisfaction until we see the value of our day's work. Satisfaction comes from doing the job on time and reaching our goal just for today. If procrastination had an effect on only ourselves, it wouldn't be so bad. But no, it puts a strain on those around us. Tight schedules leave little time for conversation or for relaxed meal times, and no time to fit in the family activities. Procrastination tends to lock us out of our community, even the community of the program. How can we share when we are in a state of mind that is preoccupied with ourselves and our problems? Working on this character defect allows us to participate in our personal and fellowship life. The ability to concentrate, to use our time well, is everything. It is self-control. It's the program in action. The fourth step speaks of instinct gone wild. We must get control of our instincts. When we are tired, we have feelings of uneasiness. These feelings come from stress and the strain of always rushing around. But the feeling of uneasiness also comes from an undernourished spirit. a spirit that never has time to go away to a quiet place and rest a while. Don't we have enough in today's own troubles without making a double load for tomorrow? Benjamin Franklin said, "Do you love life? Then do not squander time, for that is the stuff life is made of." The 12 steps are the same for everyone. We are all given the choice, the means to break the habit of procrastination so we may be free to strive for spiritual growth in our lives. The next defect to examine is covetousness, desire for material wealth or gain while ignoring the realm of the spiritual. We have a distorted view of coveting in society. Much like envy, coveting, or avarice, or desire, or greed, is cultivated by advertising and the media. We have to possess what others have. We must own and keep and grasp and hold tight all that we can. Examine what is behind it. Usually, fear. Don't TV commercials make us fear we're less than if we don't have the advertised product? The other sense of this word is coveting another person's partner. To inappropriately desire another or a thing is to covet. We covet all the time. It is important to examine this in our lives. Covetousness brings up questions of ownership versus stewardship, open-handedness versus grasping and holding, and generosity versus greed and avarice. Where do we stand with these things in our lives? These are very weighty questions. It brings into question our whole view of the world, the people in it, and how we deal with them. Are we greedy? Do we grab and reach and pull and grasp all that we can at the cost of others and ourselves? Do we value what we own and who we are in a relationship with more than who we are and who they are? Is status more important to us than substance? Are we more interested in holding and obtaining power than in becoming and reaching our potential? We are asking more questions than we are answering here, but this is an important function of becoming entirely ready. We must have a fairly accurate idea of how we view life and how we operate if we are to be in a position to let go of our defects and help in transforming and changing. Most of us do not take the time to closely examine our lives and our manner of living. We make basic assumptions early in life and go on from there, rarely questioning if they need to be changed and if they were effective to begin with. Many of us took the values and methods of our parents at face value, even though we thought we rebelled and changed from them, and find ourselves living very similar lives to theirs. It is important to make sure we know what kind of life we are living if we are to change it. This is why taking the fifth step is so important. For that matter, what a great opportunity the 12 steps offer us in reclaiming our lives. By accepting God's help, we learn to think clearly, honestly examine our lives, play fairly, and give generously. Our values change in recovery as we become less selfish and more useful. The value screen through which we see life changes. We no longer ask only what everyone can do for us. We also ask what we can do for them. We no longer only seek out situations that comfort only us. We also discover ways to comfort. We find that we feel better about ourselves when we help others. We learn from our program that what we may have been searching for our whole lives is wrapped up in service to others. Our most valuable relationship is the one we have with our higher power. So we seek out situations and people that bring us into closer contact with our higher power. The values we show in the work of recovery look different from the ones we once held. Every day brings a new opportunity to work on our character defects because our values no longer change with every passing fancy. Our life now means something and counts for things that are good. The next defect to examine is lust, excessive craving for the pleasures of the body. Sex and many issues surrounding sex may be the most misunderstood and confusing area in recovery. Most of us never learned or were never modeled intimacy, so we confused sex with love and lust with desire. For many of us, power is an issue in sex and lust, as is self-esteem. All this stuff gets wrapped up and mixed together and called sex or love or making love or intimacy. We usually don't have a clue what it is or what we're doing. There is much recent research that concludes that many addicted people came from abusive, dysfunctional situations. As strongly as the evidence suggests that genetics plays the key role in determining a predisposition toward alcoholism and addictive behavior, new studies seem to indicate it is how we are treated and shown emotional context and modeling that determines how we move forward. Although many of us may have come from less than ideal family situations, Sponsors remind us that we, not our families, are working this step as we are right now. It makes sense that if we never learned to handle our feelings, we'd have to find a way to get by. Drugs, sex, alcohol, or something. If we came from a family that denied, kept secrets, shamed, repressed and suppressed, physically, emotionally, or sexually abused us, or took part in any number of other ways of creating distortion in emotional, physical, and sexual responses, odds are our sex life is goofy and has been for a long time. Many of us confuse having sex with being intimate. Many of us think that being accepted sexually is the same as being loved, only to be disappointed again and again. Many of us use sex to act out our aggression and hate of the opposite sex in many different acts and obsessions. Men in particular seem to be drawn toward pornography and can have very active fantasy lives with very little contact with reality. Advertising and the media have molded and shaped our perceptions of what is and is not a normal love life and how people relate to each other. If we grew up without a good model for intimacy, we may think of some of the junk we see on TV, in the movies, and in the print ads is how people really behave and relate. If so, we are in for a long and confusing journey. Lust and all the areas associated with love and sex is an area we need to closely examine in the light of our spiritual values. What do we really think of other people? Are they objects to be used and discarded, to be fondled and played with? Or are they people with feelings and hearts and depth to be cherished and nurtured and honored, just as we would wish to be? How do we treat the people we love, warmly and openly and with respect, or as badly as we wish, since after all we love them and they love us and they have to put up with us? It is natural to have sexual drives and desires. It is part of being a spiritual being to express love through the body, openly, affectionately, passionately, and freely. In light of those spiritual values, it is important to examine monogamy. With sexually transmitted diseases being fatal or permanent now, it also is prudent to practice safe sex under all circumstances and all the aspects of being a sexual spiritual person. We are reminded what the Big Book says about sex on page 69. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. What comes from our higher power is to be honored and treated with respect. Our sexuality has unlimited potential for good. We have so often turned this power in on ourselves and been destroyed by it or allowed it to destroy others. The sixth and seventh steps let us change our feelings about sex so that these new feelings can encourage wholesome relationships. When we walk with our higher power, our self-will doesn't run riot over our sex lives. Our spiritual awakening washes over all our relationships, even our most tender and personal. Working on our own shortcomings allows us to gain a new sense of respect. We learn we can indeed love deeply. We find that sexuality is a powerful, life-giving force that enriches, bonds, and commits us to a special person. We no longer have to face remorse and guilt from uncontrolled, self-driven lust. May we discover the joy in our God-given sexuality by treating ourselves and others with honor and respect. Being spiritual does not mean being celibate or chaste. It may include these elements for different reasons and practices, but our body is as holy as our spirit and can celebrate the gift of love just as fully in harmony with all aspects of the spirit and love. We need to look closely at how we relate to people. Do we dislike the opposite sex? Do we fear or hate our own sex? How do we identify ourselves as a sexual being? Once we are in a relationship with someone, does our behavior change? Do we quit trying, showing our feelings, and giving fully? Do we honor and respect the other person and the relationship? Once again, the more we know about our ways of dealing with the world and the people in it, the better we will be able to become entirely ready. Peter shares this observation about relationships and recovery. My first sponsor was a very interesting guy. He had been around the program for a while, was a hard-driving businessman, and was used to living fast and loose. He'd been married a long time to the same woman and had some pretty sexist ideas. He and another guy and I used to go to meetings with each other a lot, work together and saw each other socially, sometimes with our wives. My first sponsor used to go to Las Vegas pretty often with his brother and his dad and my other friend. When they were in Vegas, they would do business with prostitutes. None of them saw this as cheating on their wives, as it was a professional relationship. It got me thinking, however. When I got up on my high horse and judged my sponsor for his behavior, how was it that much different than my reading Playboy and looking at lingerie calendars? Was there that much difference between rationalizing a professional relationship and rationalizing a magazine or calendar? Wasn't it still making a sexual object out of a human being and demeaning my current relationship? What was it doing to me and my current relationship with God? I really had to ask for help to become entirely ready so I could let go of my attitudes and beliefs around sexuality and love that were sexist, belittling, and not in line with my spiritual values. I want to be in line with my values. I must ask for help. The last deadly defect or sin we will look at is anger. Anger is a difficult emotion for a lot of us to deal with because of how we were taught to deal with anger as children. Since it was not possible to show our anger toward adults, many of us have learned to deny, repress, substitute, and suppress anger. Many of us have carried this into our present situations. We never saw ourselves as angry people. We were intense, and occasionally we'd get mad, but we certainly didn't see ourselves as angry. One of the many program slogans says, "Anger is but one letter away from danger." Many of us nursed long-standing resentments. Every time we thought about them, we got angry. What makes anger so dangerous is that it burns without consuming. It feeds on itself until it overwhelms all other emotions. Anger is poison. When anger takes over, it acts with uncontrollable rage. We say things, feel things, and do things way out of proportion. Anger is emotional drunkenness. Sarah shares her experience with anger and resentments. I always knew that I was hot-tempered and I had a short fuse, but I never viewed myself as angry. I guess I should have realized I had an anger problem when I first went to treatment. I was angry when they told me that I couldn't drink. I was there because I had a drug problem, and how dare they tell me that I can't drink. I had a rebellious attitude, especially toward authority figures. I used to deal with my anger one of two ways. I was hot, explosive, enraged, hostile, or furious, or I was cold, denying and suppressing my anger. I learned that those two ways were unskillful and had negative impacts on my life. I was very sarcastic. I still am working on that because the definition of sarcasm is a cutting, often ironic remark intended to wound. And that goes against my values. I also had a lot of loud arguments with physical fights, hot, or else I experienced severe depression, headaches, and stomach aches, cold. After I spent 2 years trying to stop starting in the program, I usually relapsed at 6 months, I decided that there were some character defects I needed to deal with. I had turned so much of my anger inward that I was ashamed of myself and my behaviors. I also believed a lot of things happened to me through no fault of my own, that I was a victim. That caused me pain that I had never dealt with. I also had a large list of resentments. Step 6 is about the principle of willingness, and I became willing to make some changes. I needed to deal with the character defects of sarcasm, fear, rage, control, and anger. To me, that means don't do what I want to do. Step 7 is about humility, and I knew I needed help getting the good things. Happiness, joy, freedom, honesty, unselfishness, and purity. Again, I interpret that to be doing what I don't want to do. I need to act out of love instead of fear or anger. I decided it was time to change. I listened to the advice from someone in the program, and I went to a 5-day seminar on anger and resentments. I learned skillful ways to deal with anger. Because anger stems from fear, if I identify the fear, I can deal with the underlying issue. I also use meditation as a way to deal with my anger. I focus on my breathing and use other techniques for forgiving myself or smiling at situations that make me angry. As for my resentments, I decided to take back control of my feelings and let go of my need to punish the people that had wronged me. I no longer had to re-feel the pain from my old hurts. One night after a meeting, someone told me, "Resentment is me taking the poison and waiting for them to die." I'm no longer at the jumping-off place, wanting to die. It's time to let go and let God. My sponsor suggested that I pray for the people I have resentments toward, ask God to give them what they deserve, and eventually ask God to give them the same things I ask for myself. Being honest about my anger, first with myself and then with others, has allowed me to own my mistakes and to deal with my anger in a skillful manner. I didn't make these changes overnight, and I didn't do it alone. With my higher power as my guide, I have slowly begun the process of change. Now, with 18 months clean time, I am becoming the person he wants me to be. I believe the most satisfactory years of my existence lie ahead. Because we are in recovery doesn't mean we won't get angry, but the sixth and seventh steps give us a process of working through anger. We learn that what usually fuels anger is fear and guilt. We can dissolve anger. The remedy for fear is faith, for faith means courage. When we are ready to replace our anger with faith, the fear and guilt that cause the anger is worked through and the anger is removed. Courage is what makes us do the right thing even when nobody else is doing it. We can find happiness while surrounded by darkness. We can be more loving in the middle of hate and envy, and more serene when surrounded by chaos, fear, and anger. The ideas of the sixth and seventh steps help us face impossible odds. We learn that any act of courage may produce future victory for ourselves and others. The courage, which we want, takes its strength from faith, not from bravery or physical power. Let truth and faith, our readiness and humble quest, give us courage so that when fear knocks, no one is there. One word often heard in group discussions is willingness. Yet the willingness to do something cannot exist without the specific action required to do it, and that takes courage. Courage to build our character. It is courage that turns possibilities into realities and assures us that progress in improving our character is possible. Experience teaches us that courage keeps our character defects under control. When courage guides our willingness, we can be sure that we will not only be capable of accomplishing success, but that we are also worthy of it. When we know that a goal is worth going for, courage has judgment and carefulness as allies, even though we may be moving against the tide of popular opinion. Many of the people we come into contact with in our lives who don't live by any program or belief think our 12-step way of life is trite and full of silly slogans and ideas. We can't be concerned with opinions about our way of life, even if others think it's trite, because this way of living life has become our secret to life. We overcome our fears about setting and working toward goals. It helps us to remember courage is fear that has said its prayers. The fact is, underneath all the denial and rationalization, most of us were in a constant rage, seething. For many of us in recovery, we carry a huge load of anger without realizing it. Many of us stuff anger away like putting hungry dogs in the basement. Sooner or later, we open the basement door to express a little anger, and the hungry dogs slip out. We move into a rage out of proportion to what triggered the anger, and most of the time we don't have a clue as to what happened. Anger is a common defect in our attitudes and personalities. Like all other character defects, anger grows more harmful the longer it is contained. Unless we expose it freely for others to see, it can consume all of our good intentions. We must get the monkey off our backs before it reaches our throats. How can we possibly make peace and form worthwhile relationships unless we bring anger into the open by working steps 6 and 7? Letting go of hidden anger and returning to a stable state of mind is one of the first actions in finding a much more comfortable and acceptable peace with life. We find that letting it all out through the sixth and seventh steps is the way to become freer and happier. We continue to take daily personal assessments of our spiritual growth by monitoring our anger. The old truism of what to do when we become angry, to count to 10, helps us practice the letting go process of the sixth and seventh steps and become better suited in dealing with anger in an appropriate way. Anger and fear are closely tied together, and many of us in the program learn to handle our fear with booze, drugs, food, and many other mood-altering behaviors. Now that we are in recovery, we have to learn new ways of coping with fear and anger. We need to learn healthy ways of expressing anger. One of the biggest risks to a person in recovery is self-righteous anger. We become very dangerous to ourselves and others when we are right. Being right used to mean a free check to treat a person who was wrong any way we chose. Especially if we loved that person, it meant we could really cause havoc in the name of being right. Most of us never learned that right doesn't mean exclusive. There are many ways of being right. We just assumed that there was only one way. We were taught that by our parents, our places of worship, and our schools. As we move into our birthright as spiritual beings, we discover that right is a cage, not a freedom. Being right is a perspective, not a license for angry behavior. Each of us has a unique perspective, thank God, and therefore a unique way of being right. We must learn to temper our anger based on self-righteousness and learn to open our minds and hearts to different points of view. It doesn't mean we won't get angry. It just means we won't hurt others so often with our rightness. In looking at anger as a character defect, it is important to realize that anger is a legitimate emotion. To deny all anger in the name of spiritual growth is as unhealthy as being angry all the time in the name of being right. We get angry. We need to learn how to express that anger in a healthy, non-damaging manner. It is the inappropriate expression of anger and the out-of-proportion expression of anger that is a defect and causes us and others harm. It was at a meeting that an old-timer said, "I am punished by my defects of character, not because I have them." Newcomers can be puzzled by that comment for a long time. How could we be punished by our defects? Then it dawns on them. God doesn't need to keep a watch on us and note our defects. Our defects keep us from becoming all that we can become and limit our ability to grow. Joe McHugh reminds us, when we have taken the first 5 steps, it is at this point that many people make the mistake of turning it over to God and expecting God to apply steps 6 and 7 to their lives. But these are our steps. God doesn't need to take steps 6 and 7. We do. Lack of power is our dilemma. Anger and the other 6 sins keeps us from God. Without God, we lack the power to live. Another view of this is the story about Buddha talking to some of his students about anger. Buddha said, "Anger is like picking up a burning coal with the intention of throwing it at another person. We are the ones who get burned in the process." Let's take a look at Joe's story. Before my recovery began 5 years ago, the 7 deadly sins accurately described my basic character. After my last drink, I discovered to my amazed awakening that the 7 deadly sins accurately described human nature. Were steps 6 and 7 going to change my basic human nature? I doubted it. So it took me 4 years of somewhat miserable dryness to get to the 7th step prayer. But then I was in for some surprises. 7 of them. Slowly, very slowly, at a caterpillar pace, I realized, I love program realizations, that God is in the transformation business. Before I was even fully aware of it, a change was taking place in my behavior. As a drinking author, I took great pride in my work. My pride far surpassed my accomplishments. My ego was always fatter than my bank account. Through recovery, I have learned to write what I like and to like what I write. I no longer reach for the proverbial brass ring or yearn to write the nation's next bestseller. I've lowered my sights and have found my true niche. I am content, and I like myself more this way. Surprise! Step 7 has changed pride into self-esteem. Did I mention yearning for literary fame and fortune? Well, I never worked toward such a goal. I wrote for money. My sole motive was personal gain, no more, no less. Today, I write from a new heart with a listener's mental and spiritual welfare in mind. Surprise! Caring and sharing have replaced selfishness. When I was a drinking drunk, I firmly believed that lust was a natural part of the human makeup. I often wrote highly of it, using acceptable euphemisms such as eros, passion, fervent love, and burning desire. It wasn't until sobriety in my 3rd marriage that I could respect, trust, adore, obey, or be true to a loving woman. My grandiose ego is far less grandiose. I now enjoy what I once thought was a contradiction in terms, moral sex. Surprise! Love has conquered lust. Anger was my middle name. Getting even was the name of my game. My bywords were, "I'll show them," and "Who do they think they are?" and "They aren't going to get away with that." This violent need to punish others blinded me to the rights of others. Sober, I learned that all people are as human as I am and no more deserving of my self-righteous anger than I am of theirs. Surprise! Anger has given way to tolerance. I was a glutton for everything sensual, including the pleasure of intoxication. As it turned out, I was really a glutton for punishment, drinking anything from beer and wine to whiskey and, on one pitiful occasion, aftershave lotion. I wanted more of everything in sight, no matter what it was. I was worse than an underprivileged kid let loose in an unguarded candy store. I was an insatiable sponge. Today, thanks to Step 7, I no longer pray to have what I want. I pray to want what I have. Surprise. Acceptance has displaced gluttony. Don't do today what you can put off till tomorrow. Remember that kind of barroom advice? I do. I lived by it. Even in sobriety, I found myself procrastinating with the steps, slow to read, study, and understand the programs outlined in the big book, faint-hearted about attending meetings, in other words, dragging my feet. That's why it took me 4 years to get to step 7. Yet this is when I discovered that I would rather make a meeting than watch TV, that I prefer the big book to novels, that I'd rather pray than think. Surprise! The joy of living has replaced sloth. Today I understand envy as the incredible sadness that overwhelmed me when others were successful. I was hypercritical and insanely jealous of the greats, never once looking at the time, energy, and work they put into their success. I simply resented their good luck, connections, or secret. Today I find myself admiring hardworking people who make it. There was a time, by the way, when I resented the winners in the program. I now let them serve as examples for me. Surprise! I stick with the winners. Envy is being replaced by inspiration. Today I live in a daily state of surprise as step 6 and 7 work on me. I have surrendered to the spiritual process that neutralizes character defects. Someday, maybe mine will be removed. As I said at the beginning, I move at a caterpillar pace. But that's okay today. As a slow-moving caterpillar spinning my cocoon to the design of the 12 steps, I will emerge free as a butterfly. That's a promise God always keeps. We take a look at the part anger plays in our life and how appropriate our expression of anger is. Are we right a lot? Are we upset and judgmental a lot? Are people afraid of us? Do we punish people with our rightness? We look at anger and its consequences and then move toward being entirely ready to let it go. It is time now to put this discussion into balance and prepare to move on to the 7th step. We have asked a lot of hard questions. We examined some pretty difficult areas of living. We've decided to look for excess in our lives. We are now ready to take action. What exactly does that mean? Can you see why it says in the 12 and 12 that this is the step that separates the men and women, winners from the boys and girls, losers? It is gut check time. Are we ready to change our ways of living or not? It is not a maybe proposition. It is fish or cut bait. Let's fill that big self-centered hole in our being with spiritual usefulness. Perhaps many of us have approached this step and the one to follow in a less active manner. Odds are we may still be battling some pretty major defects in our life too. This step requires commitment and specific action. There is no better time to get to it than right now. As we're taught in the 12 steps, the chief activator of our defects has been self-centered fear. Mainly fear that we would lose something we already possessed or that we would fail to get something we demanded. Living on the basis of unsatisfied demands, we obviously were in a state of continual disturbance and frustration. Therefore, we are taught there will be no peace unless we are able to reduce these demands. We hear in the program that F-E-A-R equals frustration, ego, anxiety, and resentment. We don't want to return to the life we led before recovery, but fear should never be the reason why we don't. Fear keeps us from being open to the program and from being entirely ready. If we're only in recovery because we're afraid of returning to the old way of life, we'll never pay attention and open our hearts to learn about the new. We'll be too busy looking back over our shoulders to make sure the old life isn't creeping up on us. We have to want the program out of a desire for a new life, not out of fear for the old. Positive thinking and behavior will be in charge if we are to make any character growth. Every fear encourages negative thinking that can destroy us. Guilt and shame come from the past, just like fear. If those feelings are what drive us, we will never grow. The 6th and 7th steps let us examine our fears. We learn to take an inventory of each fear until we understand what causes it. Then we will be able to find a way to work through it. How do we reduce our fears? How do we move into graceful living and growth towards spiritual expression? The answers lie in our ability to become humble and trust through the 7th step. In concluding our discussion on step 6, we hear from Joe McHugh, who tells a favorite story. Joe McHugh on Stripping Away. I have a pretty rocking chair down in my office. When I first bought the building, someone had run off and left the chair behind. There wasn't anything else there of value, but there was this old rocking chair. It was just a horrible-looking mess, painted black with one of the rungs broken out of the back of it. I decided I'd keep it, thinking maybe one of these days I might put it together. Quite a few years went by, and it just sat in the attic. Several times, some of the guys tempted me to throw it away. In fact, I'd find it around by the dumpster, and I'd bring it back, saying I was going to look at it one of these days. I finally got this old rocking chair out of the attic and into the light downstairs so I could really see it. And as I began to look at it, I saw that it was a really fine chair. I got some paint stripper and I began to strip it. I stripped all the paint away and found that it was solid oak. I took the old raggedy bottom that had been covered over many, many times with different cloth and tacks, and I tore it off and threw it away. There was one broken rung, and I made an identical one by bending one and putting it in there. I sanded and refinished this chair. Finally, I took it to the upholstery shop. I asked the man there how much it would cost to put a nice white velvet bottom in it. He looked at it and said, "I'll be glad to put it in there. But before I fix it, I'll offer you $350 for that chair." That beautiful, valuable chair was always there. It was there all the time. It was simply covered up. That chair has always been beautiful since the day the furniture maker made it. And that's the way I am, and you are, with God's life inside us. God made us this way, beautiful and valuable. Like the rocking chair, over a period of years, I covered myself up with all sorts of things and made a big mess. The steps of this program have enabled me to uncover, discover, and discard. It's a program of getting rid of things to get down to what we want. It's not a program of getting anything. It's a program of getting rid of things, uncovering, discovering, and discarding. Step 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The key ingredient in living the seventh step is humility. There is not another subject in the program that causes more confusion than humility. It seems that every old-timer has his or her favorite definition. We all seem to get humility and humiliation confused, and many of us have a stereotypical idea of humility, a spiritual pauper wearing sackcloth and ashes. The 12-step way of life is humble, but not in any way meek. The picture many of us have of a humble person is someone afraid of his or her own shadow, whose self-image is so low that this person is afraid to stand up for him or herself. We learn that this image of humility is not what is meant in the program. We realize that the people who have stayed abstinent for some time practice a degree of humility that was foreign to them prior to recovery. For those who have made progress in their program, humility is simply a clear recognition of what and who they are. They have gotten down to their own right size. Humility is understanding that they're worthwhile. It's the middle ground between the extremes of grandiosity and intense shame. They have a sincere desire to be and become the best they can be. Today we remember that humility is not being meek. It is being our true selves. Humility for us means staying our right size and remembering we are as humble as we are grateful. For our definition, we will use this idea from Sam Shoemaker: humility equals gratitude. Humility is an attitude. As such, it must be practiced to be maintained, and it must become a discipline to be developed, just like every other attitude. In developing humility, we are faced once again with an active surrender. In asking God to remove our shortcomings, we must move and act in a manner that reflects our willingness and surrender. To do this requires spiritual values, service, perspective beyond our addiction to alcohol, drugs, food, sex, and so on, to the addictive nature of our lives. Asking through prayer and being willing to receive through humility. Trust, asking for help. Overcoming fear. Understanding and trusting the process. Dealing with stress. Responsibility, action, solution-focused thinking. We will discuss these aspects of the seventh step and find a method for making this step a foundation for the rest of our lives. The first aspect of the seventh step we'll look at is spiritual values. Part of this discussion must be a clearer focus on humility. What exactly is humility? The dictionary defines humility as the state or quality of being humble of mind or spirit. absence of pride or self-assertion or acts of self-abasement. Humble is defined as having or showing a consciousness of one's defects or shortcomings, not proud, not self-assertive, modest. Obviously, the second definition of humble is almost a word-for-word restatement of the purpose of the sixth step, to become entirely ready, conscious. So if we practice the sixth step, humility will result. That seems to make sense, doesn't it? Still, it seems as if something is missing here. Humility is our acceptance of ourselves. It is strange how we can go to school and learn a lot of facts, but never learn much along the way about ourselves. We can take up nursing, teaching, counseling, and giving ourselves to the needs of others while never having our own needs met. Why does it seem as if it is easier to solve the problems of the world than to solve our own problems? Why do we love the drama of focusing on our problems? We simply don't know ourselves very well. When we look into a mirror and attempt to understand ourselves, our conclusions about what we see are usually very different from what a friend sees. When we finally work the sixth and seventh steps and take the time and make ourselves a priority, we usually make a startling discovery. There exists within us, at all times, a higher power that is the builder of all successes and our comforter during times of trial. Many of us believe the understanding of ourselves is in direct relation to our understanding and contact with our higher power. The image we see and the identity we have is one of humility before that power. Humility is our acceptance of ourselves based on our continual surrender. An aspect of humility that is often talked about at meetings is that of being teachable. If we are humble, we are open to new ideas and new ways of seeing things. Open-mindedness is a very important part of humility. We don't know it all. There is still more we can learn, and maybe even more important, some we need to unlearn. Yet how many of us in the program aren't open to new ideas and thoughts? Especially after having been around a while, how many do we see who continue to say and do the exact same things year after year? It seems that many of us resist a clear idea of humility so we don't have to conform to it. This is a good illustration of how humility worked in Joan's recovery. What is it about Step 7 that causes so much confusion and apathy? How come we can be in the program for years and still not have a good idea what this step means? Are we so blinded by pride that we can't see the beauty of humility and the benefits of this step? Who needs humility anyway? The idea that I might need humility is not a new one. Even during the years of my active addiction with the lying and bragging, it was not all that uncommon for someone to tell me to get real. Not a bad working definition for humility, I think. After I started in recovery, my sponsor was fond of pointing out that my way was what landed me in so much difficulty. Maybe it was time to look for another way. The word humbly is awfully hard for me to swallow. Besides that, there is something else that made Step 7 an obstacle for me. It calls for yet one more contact with God, and one that is open and willing for change. This is not just about having an attitude or being ready. This is about being serious about change and doing something about it. No wonder we avoid dealing with this step. In the process of working the first through the six steps, I gained an ability to move through my fear and look toward God. I learned to talk honestly and openly in meetings, and to share my limits and fears with another human in an inventory. With the seventh, however, the situation is different. It is suggesting that since I've done the groundwork, now is the time to humbly ask to change those things that stand in my way. I was very afraid of approaching God this way. I don't know why. After all, this is the God who saved me and let me move into the program and begin a new life. Why was I balking? I had to stop in the middle of working the seventh step and do a mini inventory. I found that I had relapsed into an old form of pride. I was angry with my inability to work out my shortcomings on my own. I knew I had to relearn that if I stuck to my way of thinking and doing, I was doomed to repeatedly hook into my shortcomings. I had to get real. I've heard so many of my fellow members in recovery talk about how they had a religious upbringing but abandoned it during their active addictions, and how hard it was to even investigate a spiritual life again. I, too, was brought up in a very religious environment and have had to set it aside to reconnect with a new reality. My background also included a good dose of the work ethic that I was to be self-reliant and a self-starter. If it could be done, I could do it. Between these two forms of teaching, I became convinced that life was manageable and that with enough hard work and a proper religious attitude, my life could even be rewarding. Boy, was I in for a surprise. I had no openness of mind, no emotional or spiritual perspective for growth, no awareness that it could be any different. When I became willing to start looking at these issues in recovery, it was from a much different viewpoint. It shouldn't have been surprising that it was difficult to develop humility given the circumstances, but it was. I was used to arrogantly demanding spiritual enlightenment or groveling melodramatically for forgiveness. It was a whole different way of being to move toward humility. Gentleness and patience were new to me. Thank God that by working through the steps and opening up to any amount of humility I was capable of, things began to change. Humility became a goal and a quality rather than an obstacle and an obnoxious trait. I've come to know the seventh step as an action step that moves one into humility. By asking, we become humble, and the more we ask and open up, the more humility we can receive. These are the ideas that lead me into the area of God readiness and the ability to change and grow. By asking. Another part of humility is represented in service. Over and over again, we are told that through service we will enhance our recovery while at the same time help someone else. By focusing on the needs of others as they see them, we respond in a way that is useful and helpful. In responding to the needs of others, as we would have them respond to us, we superimpose our values and our way of living on theirs. We see value in giving our way. We don't understand why it isn't received in the same manner. We aren't practicing humility. It is said that in about the same degree as we are helpful, we will be happy. The service work we are called to do in recovery is a result of our spiritual awakening. When most of us thought of service, we thought of restaurant help, chores around the house, or washing windows. The thought of service was burdensome, if not downright irritating. We probably schemed throughout our lives to do as little service as possible. Every moment we gave to someone else was one less we could spend on ourselves. This stands to reason, for we were totally self-centered. Even those of us who acted as if we cared normally received much more than we gave. The message in the sixth and seventh steps produces other-centeredness. We, by the grace of God, care less about ourselves and more about our fellows. In the words of Joe McHugh, we are born to help one another. When we pass on our recovery, we keep it. This spiritual paradox becomes an all-determining reality for us. To keep what we have found, we must give it away. Service becomes a way of life. It is suggested that it might pay to reevaluate our 12-step work and other service work in this light. What is truly humble? Is it being open to learning from those we serve? Or is it assuming that we have the better way to give, and if they don't receive it, well, we're still sober, so it was a good experience? This step requires us to look very closely at those values we hold and how we model those values to others. If humility, being humble, is valuable to us, then we must learn to model it. Practice humility. We do the sixth step by surrendering to becoming entirely ready and conscious of our defects and shortcomings. Then the seventh step becomes natural. What other values, spiritual and otherwise, do we hold, and how do we demonstrate them? Have we examined closely the meaning and purpose of our life? The sixth and seventh steps are really asking us what is important to us. And if it is so important, where does it show in our life? Here is where we have to get to the basics. It is easy to avoid this and think we've worked the steps, but if we don't look closely at the meaning and purpose of what we're doing, the whole context of our action loses its value. We must ask ourselves hard questions, just as in the sixth step. What is the value in our life? How is our life giving meaning to others? Are we helping? Are we part of the solution or part of the problem? How does it show? How is our higher power part of our life, and how does it show? What value do we give to spirituality, and how does it show? From the answers to these questions comes our ability to share, give, act, and practice humility. Let's look at Sam's experience. I have learned from experience that staying abstinent, working the program, and attending meetings through painful times is a guarantee of personality change. We no longer have to escape our pain through using. The program has given us a previous tool, humility, which used regularly will transform pain into growth. Armed with humility, we who once dreaded change as much as death can learn to face real life with a new courage and hope. Before I entered the fellowship, I lived in a fantasy world of my own creation. I attempted to control not only effort but outcomes of situations. I tried to keep myself calm with chemicals and food, with no recognition for the ups and downs of daily living. I was seeking an unreal world of complete security, romance, and approval, and the more I tried to control, demand these things, the more chaos I created. It becomes clear to us in getting sober that we have to change. I like what Bill W. has to say about these rude awakenings in this passage from the 12 and 12. And as we grow spiritually, we find that our old attitudes toward our instincts need to undergo drastic revisions. Our desires for emotional security and wealth, for personal prestige and power, for romance and for family satisfactions, all these have to be tempered and redirected. We have learned that the satisfaction of instincts cannot be the sole end and aim of our lives. If we place instincts first, we have got the cart before the horse. We shall be pulled backward into disillusionment. But when we are willing to place spiritual growth first, then and only then do we have a real chance. Humility seems to be the basic ingredient for transforming pain into growth. In step 7 of the 12 and 12, humility is defined as the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values have to come first, and that material satisfactions are not the purpose of living. We learn that an honest desire to seek and do God's will is necessary for humility. What an order! I can't go through with it. Used to be my initial reaction to growing through the steps. I could accept solutions intellectually, but when it came to practical application, I had trouble. I know today that I don't have to do it perfectly. It takes time to get better. I know that I don't have to do it alone, that I have a wealth of wisdom and support in this fellowship at my disposal, and that gives me hope for change, growth, and new frontiers. The next aspect of the seventh step we'll discuss is that of perspective. Bill W. addressed this issue of perspective in a very famous A.A. Grapevine article in the 1950s about emotional sobriety. He was afraid that many people were missing the point of the 12 steps by focusing so narrowly on the addictive practice that brought them to the program, in his case, alcohol. As it points out in the Big Book, alcohol, or drugs, sex, food, gambling, and so on, is just a symptom. The underlying disease is much more subtle and insidious than the gross outer behaviors might suggest. It raises the question of what the additive behavior is masking. Those in recovery must be doubly on guard against compulsive behavior and mood altering through habitual activities or substances. In light of what Bill W. said about emotional sobriety and the symptom of the disease, it is imperative that members open their perspective to a larger view. The nature of the seventh step asks us to humbly be willing and let go and practice what we learned. If we must defend a lifestyle that appears to be unhealthy and addictive, are we being humble and willing? Where else in our lives are there addictive patterns? Those in recovery have to be very careful to be willing to grow and change and move past old habits of relating and to put new spiritual values into their lives. How are the relationships in our life? What patterns have we developed, and how are they changing now? Are we willing to examine that part of our life and to ask for help in changing it? Here is an example from John. Humbly asked who? To remove what? Shortcomings? What are they? It seemed as long as I kept asking these questions, even after getting answers from my sponsor and friends and from reading, I didn't have to take this step. It's like asking the question, why? Why is the unanswerable question for me? Just like little children when they ask why. When they get the answer, they ask why again and again and so on. I use the question like a hold off on step 7. The fact is, that when I took this step on one of my shortcomings, false pride, it gave me the opening I needed to continue to use this step as another self-knowledge step, like 4 and 5. Step 7 has the power of disconnecting from the old self. Certainly I have admitted my powerlessness, unmanageability, dishonesties, and childlike behavior, but they had become so much a part of me that I felt threatened to have these things removed. In fact, I considered my overreacting as a part of me that was useful, or at least it was just me, and people would have to learn to accept that about me. It's funny now, but as I received the knowledge of self, I realized that I had created the John R. Construction Company, and my specialty was walls. In the blink of an eye, I had walls erected that could keep out anyone, anything, even God. I had to file a bankruptcy notice and go through the process of surrendering all my shortcomings in order for me to get on to living without the safety of my old shortcomings. Certainly, I have still got some, but they are usually located in my pride locker. And when I am capable of an honest, humble reawakening, I will report my status to myself, to my home group, or friends in the fellowship. Of course, it is impossible for me to do that without giving it up for my higher power. So I stop building walls, make decisions, and act as if I want to be happy, serene, and sane, and go on trying to carry the message of spiritual awakenings. I know now that the best way to stay away from removing my own shortcomings is to accentuate my good characteristics and be honest about what is really a human limitation, not a character defect. I keep uppermost in my mind and heart all of those things that keep me from God, which stems from pride, mental laziness, dishonesty, and procrastination. My staying right size is in direct proportion to my gratitude for the life I have in recovery. Thank God he is working on them now. If he wasn't, I would not have written this. Looking beyond our addiction of choice to other areas of our lives allows us to see the addictive patterns in a lot of what we do and feel. Being willing to gain a new perspective is a large part of gaining humility and realizing that there may be much more to our difficulties than drinking and drugging and all the rest of it. We have a disease that affects our life. We need to be willing to see that and to go forward with changing it. With our higher power's help and with awareness, we can move closer to our true potential as useful spiritual beings. A new perspective can also be called the surrender attitude, as related by Nancy. A few years ago, I made a very fortunate discovery while going through a very difficult period in my recovery. As a result of this discovery, the seventh step became my way of dealing with the everyday business of living. The emotional impact of this discovery was very much like having a spiritual awakening. The feelings of exhilaration persisted for several weeks. For a while, I'd been working myself into a near collapse over my inability to handle my financial affairs. I make a good income, and I know there is no good reason for running out of money, yet time and time again I would overspend and borrow to make up for the deficit and run my charge cards to the limit. Of course, this particular time was not the first bit of despair I had felt about my money-handling habits. My careful budget and intentions to stick with it this time proved fruitless. I was very unhappy and discouraged. I felt inadequate and doubted my ability to manage my life and move ahead. I was becoming more and more desperate. Then, out of nowhere, came the thought that I was dealing with a serious character defect. I don't know why I hadn't seen it that way before, but I hadn't. I felt sure I could handle it on my own. Seeing it in the light of a character defect put a whole new spin on it. I knew I had better turn to God for help. I was by myself at home, so I did what Dr. Bob, AA's co-founder, always counseled newcomers to do. I fell on my knees and said out loud, "God, I need help. I can't handle this by myself." Almost immediately, I felt a sense of relief and hope. My mind began to clear, and I started having some good ideas about how to get myself out of the financial mess I'd created. Soon, I was able to put some of those ideas into action. Weeks later, I developed methods for keeping myself from falling into that financial sinkhole again. A couple of days after the initial discovery, I remembered two other surrender experiences that happened to me during my early recovery. The first resulted in my wholehearted acceptance of the program and having the compulsion to drink lifted from me. The second happened later and resulted in the resolution of a long-standing inner conflict that would have stood in the way of any possible long-term sobriety and serenity. I saw that the seventh step could be applied whenever I confronted a similar situation that seemed hopeless and helpless. Usually it involves my blindness to my own defects. Whenever I find myself uptight or bordering on panic, I fall on my knees, figuratively or literally if I can, and ask for God's help. My life is now marked by a series of surrenders, and it has never been better. As the years have passed, I've gained a new and deeper insight into the workings of the seventh step. It is this. If I were able to retain the feeling and attitude that I gain immediately after surrendering, life would be a continuous, serene experience. I don't always hold on to that attitude as I move away from being willing to surrender. Let's call it a surrender attitude. It is an avenue to peace and harmony, I've learned that it is not so important what happens to me as it is how I view it. If I can see through the eyes of the seventh step, it all can change for the better. The next area we'll discuss is learning to understand our fear. As was stated in the discussion of the sixth step, self-centered fear is seen as the chief activator of our character defects. It can be stated that many of the faces of fear are character defects. Many of us tend to deny and sublimate fear, and it shows up in our lives as procrastination, greed, tardiness, overachievement, underachievement, poor diet, escape reading, self-pity, indecision, overspending, gossiping, lying, smoking, shyness, aggressiveness, bragging, and many more. If it is true that there are only two main emotions in life, love and fear, then all that we don't do out of love, we are doing out of fear. It certainly makes one wonder, doesn't it? In recovery, we must constantly challenge ourselves to see which emotion we are acting from. Am I giving love, or am I acting out of fear, or frozen out of fear? We must constantly examine our motives and be willing to own and name our feelings. For many of us, the unnamed fears and the sense of impending doom haunted us during our active addiction days. Those same feelings, in a more subtle form, may still be active in our lives. The way to get through fear is action, and to ask for help. That is what the seventh step is primarily about. The hardest part of this step is facing our fear. It may be the hardest part of life. Learning to name our fears and understanding the underlying pain and hurt and frustration that cause us to shun away from living fully and completely is our aim. Seeing the many faces of fear and not denying or suppressing them is the healthiest way to change our character defects. Most of us need help to face our fears. Most of us need help to change. That is what humbling asking is for. The fifth step gives us a sense of our fears, and the sixth step, our willingness to let them go. The seventh step gives us the means to do it. By moving into humility and specific action where we can, and asking for help where we need it, we can give up acting through our character defects. Does that mean that we never act out of fear, anger, greed, lust, or any of our other defects? Not at all. What it does mean is that we become increasingly aware of those times when we do act out of character. We become more conscious of our motives and intentions before we act. We choose to see the world differently. Therefore, we act differently. That is why choosing a new perspective, a larger perspective beyond addiction, is so important. We must develop vision and the willingness to put that vision into action. How do we find the fear and anger active in our lives and bring it to an awareness level where we can deal with it in a healthy manner? That is probably the root question for the sixth and seventh steps. How do we find our fear and name it? And how do we deal with it once we've found it? The fourth and fifth steps have given us a big head start on this, but for most of us, the fourth and fifth steps were anything but fearless. Now that we have some recovery under our belts, it may be time for a new look at our fear. Let's hear from the authors of A Program for You. Step 7 and Everyday Life. When the two of us first took Step 7 some 20-plus years ago, we were concerned about how we'd be able to make a living if we had to be unselfish, honest, courageous, and considerate. Since then, we've learned that following the principles is a much better, easier, saner, and more comfortable way to live. And a much less stressful way, too. For one thing, these principles don't cause any guilt or remorse. For another, you feel a lot better about yourself, and you don't have to worry about getting caught doing things that land you in trouble. You will also get along a lot better with people. Step 7 isn't something you just do once and get it over with. You have to practice it regularly on a daily basis. At first, this may mean making yourself do what you don't want to do, but as you establish this new pattern of thinking, acting and living, you resist less and less, and eventually you want to do all those things you're doing. At this point, you don't have to make yourself do anything anymore. You just do what you know is right. And when you're not sure what's right, you ask your higher power for guidance. As you continue to practice Step 7 and live according to program principles, you start responding with love and patience. These slowly become more and more a part of your personality. Your old ideas die and are replaced with better ones. You will eventually see revolutionary changes in your life. Your relationship with your higher power, with yourself, and with other people will become better. It is time to become aware of our body. Most of us go through life totally unaware of our body and its reactions. We live in our head and rarely give much thought to our body. If we want to know fear and anger, we need to know our body. The first awareness to develop is that of our breathing. Breath is directly connected to both the autonomous nervous system and the voluntary nervous system. In other words, we can control our breathing, and it goes on automatically when we are not aware of it, unconscious, asleep, or with our attention elsewhere. Breathing is one of the few functions of the body through which we can directly affect our feelings. It is also something we can directly check to see how we are feeling. It is very easy to verify. Think back to the last time you were really scared. Totally afraid. Think about the circumstances and how you felt. How were you breathing? Chances are you were breathing rapidly and shallowly or holding your breath. Both are very common reactions to fear. Both are almost universally ignored. If we want to know how we feel, we should check our breathing. If we want to change how we feel, we need to change how we breathe. When a health practitioner, teacher, or someone wants us to relax, what is the first thing she says? That's right. Take a deep breath. Deep emotion tends to make us breathe differently. The more aware we are of our breathing, the more connected we are to our emotions. Aaron's story is another example of changed perspective. As I look back over my 7th year of sobriety, I realize it was my best year ever. It was linked inextricably with the 7th step and with the unshakable law in the universe that says what isn't growing is dying. Dr. Silkworth pointed out in the Big Book that unless an alcoholic can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of recovery. An entire psychic change is nothing short of continual growth. Growth is almost always uncomfortable for me. Last year, I was frequently confronted with pain and the need to change. I resisted a lot of this change because it is difficult for me. I'm addicted to my comfort zone. When I am confronted with yet another character defect, I usually find pain. I usually try to rationalize the defect away and try to blame it on somebody else. This is one of my favorite ways of denying. And finally, I resort to promises that I'll never give this up totally. Last week, I came up against a defect that took me to that point. So I decided to go to a meeting. It was on exactly what I needed to hear. Funny how that works out. Step 7. As I listened to the members of the group share their practical experience with this step, I became increasingly aware that I didn't want to give up this particular defect because I was afraid. Afraid of what would become of me. Afraid of what God might change me into. What if I didn't like what happened? When it was my turn to talk, I found myself unburdening my soul to the group, and I shared my first real experience with Step 7, which happened during my 3rd year of sobriety. I'd been working on 6 and 7 for a long time and was getting nowhere. My sponsor realized I was stuck and wrangled an invitation for me to talk at a speaker's meeting about the 6th and 7th steps. I spent the rest of the week in a panic, knowing I had the words but lacked a true understanding of the steps because of my fear of change. The morning of the Friday I was going to speak, I was met at the back door of the college where I work. 2 of my students were waiting for me with big grins on their faces and an air of secrecy. Part of an assignment I'd given them was to supply examples of poetry in action. They obviously felt they had a good one. They led me into my desk where a vase was sitting with a string attached, and floating above the vase was a big yellow balloon. It was a very nice-looking arrangement, with a juxtaposition of balloon for flower in the composition. They had written a poem on the balloon. Both of the students were brimming with fun and confidence. Then they told me to pop the balloon. I couldn't. I hate to pop balloons. I hate the noise. It really bothers me to see a balloon pop. It scares me. Usually I let out a little screech when it happens. They handed me a hat pin and said, "Pop it." They weren't going to take no for an answer. Finally, I took the pin, put one hand over my ear, and closed my eyes. I lunged forward with the pin and heard the balloon pop. I didn't screech. I opened my eyes and saw an amazing sight. Concealed inside the now disintegrated balloon was a flower. I had no idea how they got it inside the balloon. I felt my eyes fill with tears of joy. At last, I understood the 7th step. I am just like that balloon. I am so full of hot air that I am afraid to let God pop the balloon and let the flower out. My pride and fear keep me from discovering my own flower and the flowers of others. That night I shared my story with a room full of grateful drunks and saw lots of flowers in the room. It was like being in God's garden. I too am part of that garden. I have learned to look at others and see the flower. I may not always see my own, yet through trusting God and practicing the sixth and seventh steps, I can change and grow. By seeing how my fellow travelers in recovery continue to blossom and grow, I can develop faith that I too am growing and changing. Another way we can gain some knowledge of our fear and anger is by noticing our habitual holding spots, or where in our body we hold our stress. We each hold emotions in different places of our bodies. It was like being kicked in the guts. It knocked the wind right out of me. I feel rubber-kneed. I'm stiff as a board. My stomach is on fire. My neck is so stiff that I can't turn my head. All these statements are about physical symptoms of emotional states. Not too many of us take the time to make the connections and to correct the underlying causes. Frank's comments on stress are helpful. When I find myself in the grip of emotional stress, I force myself to be outgoing rather than to retreat into isolation. My mind is a terrible place to live. My wonderful daydreams often turn into stressful nightmares. My mind magnifies my emotions and lets my character defects out of their cages. My mind, ego, tells me that I'm more in love than I am, angrier than I am, more powerful than I am, and mostly more miserable than I am. When I let stress push me into isolation, I become prey to what the program calls stinking thinking. There is only stress when my mind is allowed to work its own way. I need people. I need the fellowship. I need to humbly ask God for help. When people are hard to find, I use the phone. Stress can cause me to hide inside myself, making me think no one else understands. Instead of isolating, I need to reach out and share my feelings with God and others who can help. I've also been helped in dealing with stress by learning when to say no. My sponsor quoted William James to me, "The art of being wise is the art of knowing what to overlook." The benefit of the sixth and seventh steps is balance, a feeling of being centered. If I lean in one direction, I lose my balance and fall over. I can't please everyone. I can't be everything to everybody. There is a balance these steps teach me between selfishness and selflessness. I need to be careful to organize my time, establish boundaries, and set priorities. I can't sponsor everyone, be at every meeting, or volunteer for every service opportunity. Recovery is not a stressful race to see who can do the most. Easy does it. I let myself get too stressed out when I'm not careful about scheduling my time. I have been learning and practicing what are called refusal skills. I need to learn when to say no. I have the right to refuse requests, to slow down and take time out, to take care of myself. With all the awareness of the stress response and how to deal with it that has been brought to light in the past 30 years, it is still amazing how few people use this knowledge to lessen the stress and debilitating emotions in their life. How many of us carry anger and fear in our back and neck? How does our solar plexus feel when we get uptight? How is our stomach? Indigestion? Ulcers? Do we get headaches regularly? Do we grit our teeth or grind them in our sleep? It is important to become aware of how we place emotions in our body and to start releasing our habitual patterns of holding them. Probably the easiest and best method of letting go of fear and anger is through exercise. It not only benefits us through the actual physical exertion, but it also gives us psychological and mental release. The endorphins and dopamine that are released through aerobic exercise are very beneficial. Exercise is a wonderful way to do a moving meditation and to practice spirituality. Dance, yoga, long walks, martial arts, movement classes, and sports are all ways of getting in touch with our bodies and releasing our holding patterns. Fear is a fact of life. Those people who prosper and grow with their fear are those who move through it. We learn to recognize fear in our body and move with it and through it. We do something to release it physically. Let's hear from Curtis. I had a big fear of physical exercise or doing anything about my overweight, under-exercised body during the first 8 years of my recovery. Yes, folks, I waited 8 years before I looked at that part of my recovery. My first 8 years had been very rewarding in other areas, but I was not practicing awareness, acceptance, or surrender about my physical well-being. I'm not sure if I had an eating disorder, but I did manage to stay in a diet of donuts, cheese, and crackers. I loved those carbs. It showed in my physical appearance, but I was in denial about being fat, except that I felt and thought I should be wearing a t-shirt at all times with the words, "I hate myself," on the front. It may sound too simple, but I just got sick of it and wanted to have my physical body not be an issue anymore. Boy, do I dislike that word, issue. So in wanting to be entirely ready to do something to move through my fear, to put this issue, like so many others in recovery, behind me, I took action. But not on my own. I make the most progress when I ask for help. I found 3 program friends to be my physical well-being sponsors. They were in the fields of diet, Marilyn, and exercise, Todd and Lisa. I learned about nutrition and slowly removed the sugary, high-fat foods from my diet. I made a commitment to Todd and Lisa to join a gym and begin working out. I repeated the often-used program slogan, "What you are is God's gift to you. What you make of yourself is your gift to God." And, "Dear God, I have a problem. Me. Dear child, I have an answer. Me." Why was I up most of the night before the first day at the gym? Was it shame and guilt? Lack of self-esteem? Fear of other people looking at me? I don't know. And knowing the reason really doesn't matter in the big picture. The next day, I just went ahead and walked into the gym. But I was also helped by another friend, Phil. Phil's not in a 12-step program, and as we learn, quite a lot of help comes to us from friends not in recovery. Phil is like many people in the world, kind, helpful, and supportive. Phil had been going to this certain gym and had been helped by Tom, a personal trainer. So I hired Tom to get me going on my exercise program. This was the biggest help, to have someone guide me gently into a regular workout program. It's now 3 years later. I've lost weight, and I work out 4 times a week. My physical recovery is not an I hate myself issue anymore. I worked the 6th and 7th steps with the help of my higher power and Marilyn, Todd, Lisa, Phil, and Tom. If there is one thing I'd like to pass on to others about my experience, it is this. My active, crazy, addictive, using years were just symptoms of something else going on with me. The longer I'm in recovery, the more I realize how different my thinking is from most people. I am my biggest problem. The more awareness I have of my being an alcoholic forever and my tending to be self-defeating, the more progress I make. The more I realize how sick I am, the more my sense of humor grows about my way of viewing the world when I'm alone, how my aloneness gets me jammed up. I just can't do much by myself. I need God, the steps, and my friends. After practicing a physical approach, a spiritual and mental approach will be very effective. This is where prayer and meditation, as we discussed in the 6th step, can be of great help. Prayer is how we put our humility into action. Prayer and meditation are frequently associated with the 3rd and 11th steps. However, it is extremely important to recognize the place of prayer and humbly asking. How else are we to approach our higher power when asking for help? Knowing our place in life, knowing where we stand with our defects, being aware of the process of change and growth, recognizing all these factors in our lives makes it very plain that we can use all the help we can get. We get that help by asking. Gail relates to us about asking for help. I heard early in recovery that fear is the dark room where negatives are developed. Unrealistic fear used to haunt me and was behind most of my resentments. Fear used to attack me because I was alone and isolated. I only saw dark clouds over my head, and all appeared hopeless and negative. The 6th and 7th steps have made a difference in my being full of fear. I began to overcome my character defects of unreasonable fear by asking my fellow members and my higher power for help. I learned these 2 sources give me the support I need. But they are not mind readers. I have to open my mouth and share my struggles. I remember when I share experiences, I can also be sharing troubles. I have learned to share problems as well as solutions. The Bible says, "Ask and you shall receive. Knock and the door will be opened." Most of us never ask. Or when we do ask, it is self-centered and self-serving. Prayer is not about self-centered requests for more money, possessions, or power. It is about becoming who we can become. It is about progress. It is about serving to our fullest capacity. The humility in asking is very important. If we haven't taken the time to put our lives in perspective and to examine the way in which we operate, we will not be aware of those places where we need the most help. It is our awareness and consciousness that need to be addressed, not our higher powers. If we don't become accountable and responsible, then it doesn't matter what we ask for, we won't get it. A lot of people talk about asking and living in a manner consistent with their spiritual beliefs, yet say they are not where they want to be in life. They never stop to consider that they've given away the accountability for their lives, and along with it, the ability to change. This is the big danger in cults, and it can be a danger in a 12-step program. People think that turning it over takes away personal accountability. After all, my life is in my higher power's hands. If it's out of control, it's not my problem. I've done my part. I turned it over. In cults, it is even more insidious. If I follow all the rules and beliefs of the cult, I will receive the benefits of that belief, enlightenment, or spiritual growth. If I don't grow or become enlightened, it is because I don't believe enough or haven't followed the rules enough. My life is in the hands of the one true leader, or guru, or minister, or teacher. I've surrendered to this belief. Therefore, I don't need to be accountable anymore for that area of my life. It is a cunning trap. It can happen at work. It can happen with a boss. It can happen in the program. We must be very careful to stay accountable, to ask questions, to ask our higher power, to pray. It is important to question. That is how we learn. Those who say, shut up and listen, you'll learn more with your mouth closed and your ears open, are sometimes the very people afraid to question their own lives. It doesn't matter if we are new in recovery or have 30 years. We need to question what goes on around us and what is happening in our own life. We don't let someone else bring us down to his or her level. We need to be selfish about our recovery. We may, in many respects, be powerless over people, places, and things, but we are not powerless over unnecessary hassles in our lives. We ask our higher power for direction and grace, but remain accountable for the decisions we make. It is by God's gift that we have free will. Asking and surrendering are not the same as giving up accountability and choice. What do we ask for in our prayer? It seems that a humble prayer would contain a request for an awareness of those character defects that hurt ourselves and others. It would also ask for ways or methods of ridding ourselves of those defects. It might be thankful for all the progress we've already been given and all the gifts in our lives. It might also ask that we be shown ways to provide greater service. Such a prayer, which may be the way to work, step 7, goes something like this. God, or higher power, thank you for the gift of my recovery and for all the benefits in my life. Please allow me to be open and grateful for the bounty of friends, family, growth, and much more in my life. Please help me gain an awareness of those shortcomings that hinder my service to others, myself, and you. Please help me find a way to remove those character defects in my life, both the ones I'm currently aware of and those that I may gain awareness of later. Help me become who and what I may become in order to give more. Amen. A gentle, open prayer for help and of thanksgiving surely will help pave the way for change. We don't need to make it a struggle or an epic. Our prayer can be a gradual, gentle process. We choose. We get to determine how it will go with our willingness and our humility. There are a few folks in the program who don't give much credence to prayer and a higher power. Many have been in recovery for a long time and feel the quality of their lives has never been better. They question the need for prayer and asking for help in removing shortcomings. In their minds, the intellect and will alone can rid people of their defects. Yet it seems that for many of these people, there is a dimension of living joy that is missed. Even the most sophisticated physicists are seeing that the underlying principles of the universe may be mystical and spiritual. The whole basis of life and reality may be nothing more than energy of thought, maybe God's thought. If this is so, or even a remote possibility, don't we owe it to ourselves to explore the potential of our spiritual natures as completely as possible? Isn't practicing and working with prayer a way of showing our commitment to the program and of increasing the depth and width of our recovery? Doesn't belief precede action? These are very interesting questions and ones that are at the heart of working steps 6 and 7. Are we willing to become aware of our defects and to ask for help? Pretty fundamental, isn't it? Yet many of us are not ready or willing to do too much in working these steps. It is easier and maybe more rewarding in the short term to do another inventory and fifth step. It is more fulfilling and satisfying to get on with making amends. Yet, if we don't give our full effort and attention to these steps, we may miss an opportunity to change the whole way we experience life, which includes balancing our character defects and the principles of the program. Asking through prayer is a simple and direct way of putting our intent into action. Are we willing to change, or do we want to hold on to the old ways of doing and being? It is at this point, when we've made the decision to be entirely ready and to humbly ask, and we have put into action what we can, and we are acting as if, that most of us let the sixth and seventh steps slip away. We don't trust the process. Let's hear from Stephen. This is what I read in one of my recent morning meditations. God can't help us remove our character defects if we keep practicing them. Like most of the rest of the program, this statement is very simple. Why didn't I think of that before? The answer is, I didn't want to. In the words of Step 6, the first of the two defect removal steps, I wasn't ready to think that. I wasn't willing to take yet another flyer into the unknown, that free-floating world of happenings uncluttered by the squirrel cages of my control. I wasn't willing to trust. I wasn't willing to learn or change. I wasn't even willing to be willing. And that is the first condition of working with God on any problem. Oh, sure, the naysayers say about being willing, that's just another way to say, let God have his way. Let God win again. Let God tromp all over you. Turn you into the hole in the donut. Well, hey, I'm certainly glad God did the donut hole trick on my drinking. Since coming into AA, I have not had a serious urge for a drink. That desire was lifted from me. Same for the desire to use drugs. But that took more time. That was harder. I had to work at that one. I had to show God I wanted to be drug-free, and I had to ask God for help on a daily, consistent basis, and most of all, I had to mean what I said. I had to be willing to be released from that compulsion. I had to be convinced that drug use was not to my benefit. I had to say, I can't. You can. Please help me. These days I'm working on the defects of gluttony and lust. These twin slobs follow me around day after day, blubbering for more. You've given up drinking, and you've given up drugging, and you've given up smoking, they whine. So why not indulge us? Why not take your ease with us? The reasons why I don't are all the same. Any excessive indulgence opens me up to feeling I can do it all, have it all, control it all, ego whip the world with my will. And that kind of behavior doesn't work anymore. I have to face the fact that I am not an ordinary guy. How I loved that distinction when I was drinking. How it drives me nuts now. I know for myself I don't have built into my system many of the rational controls, stops, and guards that other people have. I just want to go big, zoom off the launching pad like a missile when most days what is called for is a leisurely biplane trip along the Mississippi, a trip that incorporates the world instead of blowing it off. The foxhole prayers never worked for my drinking, and they won't work for any of my other character defects. I can't ask God to help me overcome my desire for potato chips when I'm finishing off another bag. I can't ask God to help me overcome my lust when I'm giving into it, again. I can't ask for help if I'm not willing to be helped. I've got to do my part in order for God to do his. Trust in many different forms and areas may be one of the biggest issues facing us in recovery. We lost the ability to trust ourselves through years of denial, rationalization, and addictive behavior, and good intentions with little follow-through. Many of us lost the ability to trust others early in life when we were faced with loved ones who professed love, then hurt us, emotionally, physically, or sexually. We may have been abandoned in many different ways and in many different relationships. We may have been abused and shamed. We may have perpetrated all those things on others. Trusting ourselves and others and trusting God after all we've been through is asking a lot. Yet if we are to gain the ability to grow to our full potential through the program and the 12 steps, especially the 6th and 7th steps, we must learn to trust. How do we learn to trust? And what are the elements of trust? Trust, like surrender, has elements of being passive and of being active. It takes action to trust. And it takes an opening or surrendering to our feelings and being vulnerable. We talked about these elements at the beginning of Step 6, and we've come full circle to discuss them again in the completion of Step 7. Letting go of counting on results and instead surrendering to the process is what trust is about. If we've given all we have in being willing and asking for help and put it into action, our higher power will be there to remove our shortcomings and give the help we need. The element of doubt arises because we don't know that we've done all we could to be ready and willing. So, rather than trusting that we've done what we could do, we doubt. Or we begin to look at ways we don't deserve to change and receive the bounty of the universe and the rewards of letting go of our defects, and we begin at a subconscious level to sabotage our efforts and perception. We gain trust the same way that some old-style investment houses get money. We earn it. We gain trust for ourselves by being trustworthy. Isn't that a great word? Trustworthy. It is a very valuable word and an invaluable insight. We become capable of trusting by being trustworthy. It boils down to our personal integrity, our responsible actions. All the questions we've been asking ourselves about how we live and relate and think and feel gain focus when we decide on a harmonious way of living. Do we live a spiritual life? Do we live as though we've taken a third and 11th step? Do we act as if? The more our actions come into line with our intentions, the more trustworthy we become. When our actions are out of line, we must surrender to the process, ask for help, and trust that it will be forthcoming. We may not be able to pick the form or method of help. We may not recognize it when it arrives, but it does come. Usually it arrives in the form of an opportunity to do some work, or it arrives in the form of a crisis that might give us a way of seeing things differently. It is like the old story of the man in the flood. A man who believed in God devotedly lived by a river which flooded on occasion. One spring the rains fell heavily and the river began to rise. Soon it was above the foundation of the man's house. A sheriff came by in a 4x4 truck offering the man a lift and telling him it was time to evacuate the area. The man refused the ride, stating, "God will take care of me." The river continued to rise and soon the man was forced up to the second floor of his house. Looking out his window, he saw a rescue boat approach. Opening the window, he shouted to them to go away after they had offered to rescue him. He said, "God will take care of me." The river continued to rise, and the man was forced out of the second floor onto the roof where he climbed up to the chimney and held on. The river rose to where it was swirling around his legs and torso, threatening to tear him away into the rushing water. A helicopter came swooping out of the darkening sky and started to lower a rescue sling to lift the man out of jeopardy. He waved the chopper off, shouting, "God will take care of me." Very soon after the helicopter left, the man was swept off the roof into the raging flood and drowned. Upon arriving in heaven, he was greeted by Saint Peter and taken before God. Before God could greet him or say, "Hello," or "How do you do?" the man angrily demanded to know why God had let him down. After all, he had great faith and trust in the Lord. God said to the man, "I sent a 4x4 truck, a boat, and a helicopter to help you. What more could I do?" Many of us are like the man with a house by the river. We don't recognize the help that comes our way every day. Trust is learning to see the help that is already available in our lives and knowing that more is being provided on a regular basis. We must learn to give fully in our efforts to not drown and let go of the results. Trust is twofold in nature. One, learning to trust ourselves by being true to our integrity and giving full effort and willingness. And two, surrendering to the process and knowing that help is available if we ask and understanding that if we don't see the help, it may be that we are unable to see it, not that it is unavailable. Trust comes through action. By acting worthy of trust, we gain the trust of others and ourselves. By acting trustworthy, we begin to see the help available when we are out of line with our spiritual intentions and our willingness to change. This is when we gain a true understanding of the process of the 6th and 7th steps and begin to see the lessons take hold in our lives. The only things we used to trust were the things we were addicted to. When we began to put our trust in the program and our higher power, the destruction stopped and recovery began. Bob shares his perspective. Detailed investigations extended over many years now enable me to present concrete evidence that there is a worldwide conspiracy among countless individuals who point out my character defects to me. I continually uncover such plots and am becoming better at spotting them in my never-ending search to find others to blame. I'm called an old-timer because I've been in the program over 20 years, actually 27. But I'm not that old, almost 50, and was lucky enough to sober up as a young man. For many years, I've believed the 6th and 7th steps are the most important out of the 12. It's funny, the more years I add to my recovery, the more important they become. Here is why. First off, I've learned a lot about myself and the general character I was born with and developed since childhood. I was born with some physical, mental, genetic, or whatever predisposition toward compulsive addictive behavior. Without the knowledge from understanding and working the 6th and 7th steps, I can go to any lengths and any direction imaginable to be compulsive. I've gotten over having a chip on my shoulder about this quirk of nature, and don't blame my parents. Even if I had perfect parents, which really don't exist, I would have been quite a challenge to them anyway. I tell many newcomers they may have to do some work about their parents, but there is a big trap in blaming them while working the steps. It's too easy to get stuck blaming our parents, which continues to make the past a reliable source of unhappiness. Our parents don't work the steps for us. I believe what often happens with newcomers is that they only two-step the program. They don't use and they attend meetings. They want to still be in control, and they go around complaining about their parents, childhood, and relationships. Sure, many of us had terrible things happen to us early on, but we're in these rooms to help each other with the here and now. We can't work the steps while living life looking in a rearview mirror. In the past, most of us didn't need better families, relationships, or partners. We needed to be better people. The 6th and 7th steps are there to help us all with our real and perceived thoughts and feelings about our early years. These steps shake us into an understanding that what may have been inflicted upon us by God, the world, fate, nature, chromosomes and hormones, society, parents, relatives, the police, teachers, doctors, bosses, and especially friends and relationships, is not so bad, and the smallest suggestion that we can perhaps do something about it may get us unstuck. If we stay in the worry tower of our indignation, we prevent the healing of past injuries by constantly licking our wounds, character defects. Second, I am unquestionably one of the most self-centered people in the known world. I'm not interested in why this exists, just that I am continually aware of this defect of character. I've become so aware of my tendency towards self-centeredness, it is now often funny. A good example is when, of all things, I have to wait my turn in the checkout line at a grocery or hardware store. I always get in the slow line where people are writing checks for $1.37 or talking to the clerk. I instantly start taking their inventory. How dare they make me wait, this self-appointed king of the world! I am as angry and resentful as I can be by the time I leave the store. But thanks to my progress in recovery, I have the ability to quickly shift my thoughts and feelings. I am laughing at myself before I reach my car. In the old days, that type of situation would have catapulted me into all sorts of negative self-defeating behavior. On the way to my car, full of anger and resentments, I repeat two words, my usefulness. It's a short version of the 7th step prayer from the Big Book, which reads, My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. Working steps 6 and 7 are a constant part of my recovery process. When self-centeredness takes over in its many guises, I repeat to myself, my usefulness. When I am balanced, I am useful to myself and others. The 6th and 7th steps remind me daily that I'm ready to be useful. The action of the 6th and 7th steps culminates in dropping the rock. We let go of those things pulling us down and keeping us from being the most help we can be in service to ourselves and others. We trust in our higher power, and we trust in the process. We surrender what can be surrendered and work out the rest. We come to understand that our life has purpose. Let's hear from Joe McHugh. Every one of us was put here on earth to serve a specific purpose, to do a specific job. That is God's will for us. We have within us the knowledge of what that job is. The challenge is whether we do that job while we are here or whether we go do our own thing. I've learned from many years of experience that the happiest we will ever be is when we can find out what our job is and start doing it. We will feel better, perform better, and be better because we will be in God's purpose. The sixth and seventh steps are where the movement into serenity begins. Through step five, we've been learning to know a higher power, seeking the nature of our addictions, and admitting the wreckage of our past. Now, we are ready for action. Up to now, it has been mostly internal work. We've stopped our active addictive behavior, but have we changed the way we think, behave, and feel? It is no mistake that we must begin to do and understand these steps before making amends. If we're not willing to change our behavior, then where is the value in an amend? These steps are action steps, down and dirty, to the core of our lives steps. They require accountability, and they require action. Two reasons that most people avoid them or make them into nodders. And after amends, we keep working these steps as we gain more awareness about ourselves. We come to understand how our character defects are the opposite of the principles of our program. The longer our time in recovery, the easier it is to fool ourselves and others that we've done these steps. We need to take a very close look at all the implications of these two quiet steps and become responsible for working them during our entire recovery journey. Please join in working toward emotional sobriety, recovery with balance, by taking a new look at the sixth and seventh steps. Then jump into action and surrender, making positive progress through a continuing series of spiritual awakenings. We spend less time thinking about changing our character defects. We mature, we change our character defects. The answers will come when your own house is in order. Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace. Taking as He did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that He will make all things right if I surrender to His will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with Him forever in the next. Sanskrit proverb. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lies all the realities and verities of existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Prayer of Saint Francis of Assisi. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Set aside prayer. Lord, today help me set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery for a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and my own recovery. The 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Drop the rock. If there is anybody new here tonight, and I hope there are some new people, there's one last thing that I think you have to do in order to have the miracle of AA take place. All you have to do, if you're new, is don't drink. Turn your life over to God and get rid of all of your old ideas. That's all we ask. That's all we ask that you do. When I heard about turning over all my old ideas, I realized that all of my old ideas was my whole game plan for living. My whole plan. Everything. Every conviction, every attitude, every prejudice, everything that I had about the world are my ideas. And it was like carrying around a 150-pound rock. But it was my rock. It was mine. I put this thing together. This was the real me. I was this rock. And I came in here, and it was like I was in the ocean of alcoholism, and AA threw me a life preserver. But I'm hanging on to that rock. I'm not going to let that thing go. This is my rock, and they're yelling out there, drop the rock. No, man, I can't drop the rock. I'm hanging on to the life preserver, and the boat full of AA members is coming along, and I'm going under with the rock and hanging on, and I got the thing, and they are going, hey, drop the rock out there. I'm going down under, and everybody's yelling, it's great up here. Come on over. And I said, how do I get up there? Drop the rock, and you'll make it. But I don't want to drop the rock. It's mine. And so finally, one day, I don't know, something terrible happened because it took my attention away and I dropped it and I was terrified. There goes my rock. And while I was looking down there, I was like a water skier. I came out of the top of the water and I'm going along and I'm asking, what the hell? Why did I want that rock anyway? And you know, that's why we want to hold on to those old ideas with a death grip. I'll never understand it, but it's one of the paradoxes in AA. And so, if you are new, I hope this happens to you, and I want to be sitting out there next year or the year after that, whenever it takes place, because this is how I'll know about God even more. I want to be out there when some new person out there is standing up here, and you've got that sparkle in your eye, and you've got that whole vitality going about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're looking at some new guy, and you're saying, drop the rock. It's the greatest. Sandy B., June 1976, Palm Desert, California. Last 3 minutes of a 50-minute talk. The End. This is Tom Zingarelli. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Drop the Rock by Bill P., Todd W., and Sarah S. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.